It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Tim Stevens is here from theroadshow.com. Also joining us, Larry Magid from CBS Radio News, Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle. We got a lot to talk about. Tim's going to talk about his visit to the Tesla 3 launch. We've got an Oculus Rift. We'll talk about the future of VR. And, of course, wouldn't be a TWiT without an Amazon Echo commentary. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT This Week in Tech, episode 556, recorded Sunday, April 3rd, 2016. Resuming the love song of Miss Queenie Hennessy. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the simplest way to create a cover page or beautiful website for your portfolio, your blog, your business, or your online store. Enter offer code TWIT to get 10% off. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/TWIT2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/TWIT. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TWIT. And sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TWIT. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news with the best tech journalists in the business. And I always enjoy what I sometimes think of as the old-timer shows. Good old friends of mine who've been covering this business as long as I have. Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle. Always great to see you, Dwight.
Good to be here, Leo.
You still doing the blog at techblog.
I am. I'm mostly doing the social media for the Chronicle, but I still write in my blog and love every minute of it.
Good. And the I love the link roll. That's useful. I follow that. Thank you, Dwight, for doing what you do. Also with us from CBS Radio News. It's important to say news these days. Apparently, Larry Magid is here. He's also at LarrysWorld.com. Great to see you once again, Larry.
Good to see you, Leo. And Dwight, nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you again.
Right? Hey, I heard you co-wrote a great book about Vista a long time ago.
That's right.
And here's a man who's never written a book about Vista. Congratulations.
Really good for you.
The only one on the panel, Mr. Tim Stevens from CNET and TheRoadShow.com. Hey, Tim, good to see you.
Thank you for having me, Leo.
You were at the Tesla Model 3 event, I hear.
I was there. It was a late night. Pretty exciting times.
I tried to watch it, but the stream kept stopping. I got enough of it to really see the new car. It's a beautiful on the outside car. And what's was interesting to me is instead of the 17-inch panel in portrait mode, it looks like there's a regular smaller screen in horizontal landscape mode.
Yeah, 15-inch in landscape mode. That was the big surprise for me, too. One of many surprises that we had from the Model 3, but that was probably the biggest. Yeah, a big shift from what we've seen in the Model S and in the Model X, and a big shift for a lot of drivers. There's no dashboard, but I think we'll probably be talking a little bit more about that.
That was weird, yeah. So they didn't show a lot of the interior, but what I saw looked like an extremely, shall I say, clean interior.
Right. There's nothing behind the steering wheel except the dashboard itself, which is very low. All the clusters, all the gauges, everything else are built into that 15-inch touchscreen, which sits in between the seats.
I don't know if I could get used to that. That's weird.
It's definitely probably the most controversial thing that we've heard thus far about the car. But, there are a lot of good reasons for it, probably the main one being cost savings. You know, there are multiple displays on the Model S and Model X. Now on the Model 3, there'll only be that one 15-inch display in the middle that'll give you everything that you need to know. They did move it up and forward, so it is a lot closer to you than the display on the Model S or the Model X. So it is within your field of view. And you could also make the case that if the car is driving itself, which this car will be doing a fair bit of, speed limits are a little bit less of a concern. But definitely it is a big shift from what we've seen before. And it's something that we've seen on quite a few other cars, particularly lower cost models. You know, again, it's a cost savings measure. And as you're looking to launch this car internationally, which Musk definitely wants to do, it'll make that process a lot easier to swap the wheel from left to the right side.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, they do have to do that, don't they? I wonder if there's going to be a HUD, a heads-up display of speed and something, because you don't want to have to look off the road to see that stuff.
Right. I wouldn't be surprised if they offer something like that as an option. They weren't really talking options. We asked many times, but they weren't really into talking about extra battery duration or extra performance. Those things will be options, but they didn't really want to talk about what's going to be out there just yet. They still got, you know, about 18 months before they go into production. So a ways to go. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if, given all the rather critical feedback in that regard, that they do add something like a heads-up display or something like that. Yeah. So Tim, that's a pretty common feature on cars these days.
There was one thing that I was confused in when I watched a webcast. Will autopilot be an extra cost item? He said the hardware is included, but will the service be free or will you have to pay for it?
That remains to be seen. I've definitely heard back and forth on that, and I haven't gotten official confirmation.
I can weigh in on that one because I've ordered a Model X, still undelivered, and so they it's all ready, right? So they have autopilot ready. And you know, and then you have to pay money to implement it.
Will it be a monthly, an annual fee, or
well,
be
it's
a
not on
fee?
The Model S or X. It's just an extra cost that you add
one time
cost. Now there is some additional hardware for some of the things. Ludicrous mode, they have to put in extra hardware and stuff. But it wouldn't. But autopilot's just no, it isn't, is it, Tim? Because you have to have cameras too, don't you?
Yeah, there have to be cameras built into the car, and there are also the sonar sensors that are built into the bumpers, which also help for parking and that kind of thing, which need to be built in as well. So it's actually probably cheaper for them to build them into every car and then only flip the switch to enable the software than to selectively install that in different cars. But yeah, it definitely seems that, you know, this is going to be a very affordable car. It's about half the starting cost of a Model S, so they've got to cut corners where they can. Again, the dashboard is one of those things, and if they can upcharge you for software, that's another big one. But ultimately, you know, when it comes to these systems, it's really not the hardware that is the expensive part. It's the development, it's the software, it's the training, it's the it's all the stuff that goes into building those systems that's expensive, much more so than putting a couple of cameras and sensors in the car.
I guess the question I have
is the expensive part.
That $35,000 car that I ordered, what's it really going to cost?
Oh, you ordered one, Larry.
Yeah. Well, I put down the deposit.
Elon tweeted that the average cost will be $42,000 with options.
That's quite a bit more than $35,000.
That is. That's quite
20% more. It's not...
So, Tim, the inside of it looked to me in the photos that I saw and some of the video, and I understand, by the way, that you could only use a smartphone to take pictures. You couldn't actually use, like, a real camera.
No, yeah, unfortunately so.
And it looked – the inside to me looked Spartan and, frankly, looked a little cheap. And I guess maybe it's the absence of the dashboard. But it reminded me, in terms of design aesthetic, although it looked better than this, it reminded me of a Prius inside. Mm. Is that does that fit with what you saw?
It's actually very similar to the Model X. The seats are very similar to what you see in the Model X or the Model S. But definitely there's a lot of a difference. The reduction of the dashboard, the removal of all the gauges actually means that the dashboard is a lot lower. And there are no traditional vents in the car either. It's basically like a slit along the top of the dashboard that'll be giving you all the climate stuff. So that actually has a really interesting effect because the dash is so low, you actually are moved a lot further forward in the Model 3 than you are in the S or in the X. So you almost feel like you're sitting over the front axle. It's actually similar to the feeling in the McLaren 650 or 570. Where you feel like you're sitting right up in the nose of the car. You have this great view forward, which is really, really different than your average car. And actually makes the car feel very sporty. I was only in the car for a few minutes, just like everybody else. But that does give it a really interesting feel. It is a very Spartan interior, particularly because there's no roof liner. You know, it's all glass overhead, which is a very interesting thing.
All the way to the back, right?
Right.
It is all the way from the front windscreen all the way back. There is a small seam in the glass, so it's not one continuous piece of glass. It looks to be at least two pieces. But ultimately, other than a structural support that goes over the head of the driver and the passenger and another one a little bit further back, it's basically all wide open, which again makes it feel really – well, it has a bunch of effects, one being that it makes the car feel very wide open and airy. But the other thing is, because of that, there's a lot more headroom than you would normally have. And so they can move the rear seats back, and that gives you more legroom in the rear than you would – out of a car of that size normally. I didn't get a chance to get in the back seat, but it looked pretty comfortable back
then. Elon made the point that it's going to meet the 5-star safety rating, but I'm curious, when you're sitting forward, if you have a front-end collision, what impact is that going to have?
Actually, because there's no big motor up there that they had to worry about. You know, there's no V6 or something slug in between or ahead of the front seats. That's a big piece of metal that they don't have to worry about. That means they can have better crash protection and crumple zones up there without having to mitigate having a big lump of iron, basically, that they had to do something with in a frontal collision. So I definitely think that it's going to be a bit of a work for them. But ultimately, you know, we've seen great results for the Model 3, or excuse me, the Model S and the Model X. So I think we'll see good results there, too. I'm a little bit more curious about how this thing's going to do in a rollover with that glass roof, if that shatters, if that's a concern. I mean, it does have the structural support over the top, so I don't think it'll be collapsing.
It's like having a roll bar. I mean, you're not more protected than you would be in a ragtop or in a convertible, right?
I think you would be, because ultimately it's basically like they just ripped the sheet metal off of a traditional car. And you know, there's typically a couple struts going across, but otherwise it's just basically sheet metal and the headliner. So it's basically replacing that with glass, which does give you, again, more headroom. But ultimately, if that shatters, that's going to be a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, don't roll it.
Don't roll it. That's my advice. I'm curious about the insurance costs as well, because you know the windscreen effectively goes halfway back the roof, and then
imagine replacing
the
you know, you get a ding in your windscreen. Imagine replacing that.
It's going to be expensive.
Whole roof.
Wow.
Tim, have you had a chance to drive the Chevy Bolt? And if so,
well, that's what I'm interested
in. What are your impressions?
Because the Bolt is going to be very similar in price, in range, which is of course the most important thing in an electric vehicle, over 200 miles,
and here sooner.
And it's being made by a company that has a track record, a little bit more significant track record than we know. That, in other words, that when Chevy says we'll have that in the fall, that's likely that they will.
Right, and I have had the chance to drive the Chevy Bolt. Actually, I spent more time in a Bolt than in a Model 3 at this point. And they're very, very different cars. You know, people are comparing the two because similar price points and similar ranges. But the Bolt is very much a practical family car. You know, the seats fold down. There's a lot of room in the back. It's a big hatchback. You can throw your dogs in the back there, no problem. The Model 3 is not a hatchback. It's a traditional sedan with a trunk that opens up, much like a Taurus or something like that. So it's not like the Model S or the Model X in that regard. So the Bolt is going to be a much more practical car. It's not anywhere near as quick or as sporty, but it actually is quite fun to drive. You know, almost all EVs have really great throttle response. They accelerate really quickly. And the Bolt definitely has that as well. It handles quite well, too, because the battery pack is down in the floor like in the Model S or in the Model 3. So it doesn't have a lot of body roll there. But ultimately, that's a much more practical car for a lot of people. And again, the prices are going to be very, very similar for the two. But I'm a little bit wondering about how people are going to feel about charging the Bolt, because that is probably not going to have level 3 charging.
They won't have the supercharger that Tesla's taking great pains to putting everywhere.
Right. Tesla and Musk made a big point about doubling the number of superchargers in the world.
And those are free, which is totally interesting. Free. If you're a Tesla owner, you pull up to a supercharger. And how fast does that charge up, say, a 90-kilowatt Tesla?
That'll give you about 80% charge in about between 25 and 30 minutes.
That's pretty fast.
It's pretty solid. Yeah. Wow. It won't go to 100%. If you do want to go to 100%, it actually takes a lot longer to go that last 20% or so, just because of the way that they stagger the charging to protect the cells within there. But ultimately, you know, that's really quick. And there is level 3 charging that's available that'll do that for other cars as well. But certainly the network isn't anywhere near as mature as the Tesla supercharger stations are. And it's certainly not free like it is for Tesla. And Tesla's even adding superintendents to some other charging stations. So, you know, if you get there and it's full of people, you can kind of leave your car there, go off and get coffee, and when a charge is free, they'll pull your car up for you.
Tesla showed I don't know if it was a prototype or a concept of a station where you pull in and it removes your old battery and swaps in a new full battery. Mm-hmm. Is that real or was that just an idea? Are they going to make those?
It was a concept that we've seen a few other companies trying. There was a startup called Better Place that had billions of dollars in funding that completely imploded. Tesla, you know, they designed the Model S with that in mind. I think it's like 17 or 20 bolts to remove the battery pack, and it drops right down. You can pop a new one in there. When they did the Model S, I think they thought that was going to be one of the ways that they might go forward. And I think they did deploy a few battery swap stations in California, but it hasn't taken off yet. You know, it's just something that it doesn't seem like people are willing to pay for a fresher battery pack.
Yeah, I think they charge a lot, don't they, for a swap out?
Yeah, because you're getting a whole new battery pack, right?
Well, you're returning your old battery, but I think it's an expensive swap.
It'd have to be, because of wear to battery packs.
Mm-hmm. Right. It just hasn't taken off yet. They've also shown a concept, a really terrifying concept of this like mechanical snake thing that a proboscis that comes out and will automatically plug right. into your Model S. They had that demonstration as well, which I think terrified more
that's
people.
For that's for autonomous. That's so you could drive across, your car could drive by itself across the country. It would have to refuel.
I think what they want to do is basically have Model S's and Model 3's and Model X's be able to pull themselves into the supercharger right. station, plug themselves in, and as soon as they're plugged in and fully charged, unplug themselves and back out and allow somebody else to pull in automatically. I think that's right. what they want to do. There you can see the video now. It's really quite terrifying.
My question about the Model, I mean, when I was justifying this to my wife, you know, why we need a new car, because we really don't need a new car. The only argument
good news, you won't be getting one for years. Right.
You may need a new car by then. Yes.
But the argument that I sold it on is safety. I drove the Model S and I've tested the autopilot and I was blown away. I got on Highway 280, turned on the equivalent of the turn indicator, and within a half a second I was in the next lane, presumably with much lower risk than if I had looked around to make that lane change. Will the Bolt have that anytime soon, or is that going to be more of a traditional, just a warning signal, like is already on many cars?
It's pretty interesting. There's a big split between the Model 3 and the Bolt when it comes to technology. When it comes to active safety things, autonomous piloting, lane assist, and adaptive cruise, the Model 3 is definitely way ahead in that regard. You know, you can do hands-off up to 80 miles an hour on the highway, change lanes, like you mentioned, automatic braking, things like that. The Bolt will have a lot of the emergency safety things like lane departure warnings and things like that, but it won't have the full-on hands-off autonomous cruise that the Model 3 will have. So it won't be that safe in that regard. But when you look at the other side of technology, things like CarPlay, Android Auto, the Bolt will also have Bluetooth Low Energy. You can actually create digital keys for the Bolt and share them with your family. So if your brother or sister wants to borrow the car, you can create a digital key for them that they can install on their phone and start the car up, things like that. The Bolt is really progressive when it comes to the interior technology, the niceties, but it's going to be a little bit behind the Model 3 when it comes to adaptive safety. But then again, you know, the Bolt will have been on the market for about a year by the time the Model 3 comes out, and there's no reason to believe that Chevy wouldn't be adding that kind of technology as well, particularly if consumers are demanding it, which by the end of next year, they probably will be.
So, Elon, of course, the best way to know what's going on about this is to watch Elon's Twitter feed. Incidentally, he tweeted half an hour ago that the Model 3 will be rear-wheel drive only with an optional for all-wheel drive, because to do that, they have to put in two motors, front and back. He also mentioned late Saturday that there have been 276,000 pre-orders. That's 276,000 times $1,000. That's almost $30 billion.
Yeah, and that's a nice free loan for Tesla, and they can ultimately use all the money they can get right now to keep building out their manufacturing facility and, of course, building that gigafactory that they're building for batteries, which Musk said is the single largest building in terms of square footage in the world, which is pretty impressive. It's this massive white edifice out in the middle of the desert that will be producing more lithium-ion batteries than every other lithium-ion battery factory in the world put together once this thing gets into full swing, assuming it does. And there are, of course, a lot of cynics out there that think that it never will. But ultimately, you know, they need a lot of investment to keep moving that thing forward. And this is, you know, it's a drop in the bucket for them, but it is a really encouraging sign. And you know, this is, even though this is a mature company and it is a publicly traded company, they're still operating like a startup in a lot of ways. And so, you know, people look at Tesla, they look at the potential as much as they look at the profit and margins and everything else. And when you've got 270-some thousand people willing to pay you $1,000 for the privilege of being in line to buy something, you know, that's a pretty strong vote of confidence from the consumers. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that investors will eat up with a spoon.
Especially since most of us actually put down our $1,000 before we even saw an image of
what the car looked like. Sight unseen.
Yeah.
I think this, you know, I think Elon has played the greatest, most gutty brinksmanship game I've ever seen. And this is not the first time. He's famous for taking all his money and putting it into the next thing, whether it's going to Mars with SpaceX or Tesla. They've never made money. This has been just hemorrhaging money since day one. And according to people in the know, like Jason Calacanis, who's an early investor and owner and a friend of Elon's, he said, this is the end game. This is what Elon's been aiming at all along, is an affordable electric car, because he's not in it to make money. He's not in it to make cars. He's in it to save the world. So he wanted to get there as quickly as he can. And what he did is he bootstrapped his way starting with the Roadster, then the Model S, then the Model X, with very expensive, limited interest cars that paid for the next generation and the next generation. I have to think on March 29th, the day before this announcement, Elon's got to be just on pins and needles, because the reception of this car determines the future of Tesla. Had they not received many reservations, I think Tesla's out of business in a year or two. I honestly believe that. Getting more than a quarter million reservations, it's not merely about the $30 billion. It's about being able to go to investors and say, we're a real company. A quarter of a million people bought or put a deposit down on this car, sight unseen. Help us build, first of all, the NUMMI plant's capable of a lot more, the factory they own in Fremont. Help us build out the NUMMI plant. Help us build new factories. So what we don't really know is how long it's going to take. Elon basically implied late 2017, early 2018. And, of course, if you're number 272,000, well, they're only making, what, Tim, 50,000 cars a year now.
Right, and obviously they want to do multiples of that. I think NUMMI was in the mid-200,000 production per year back in the glory days of GM and Toyota. So, you know, there's every expectation that, that Tesla could be doing a lot more. And ultimately, you know, the manufacturing of these cars is in a lot of ways more simple than what GM and Toyota were building back in the day. You know, there's for the motor, there's one moving part, famously, versus, you know, a V6, which has hundreds of moving parts. That simplifies things greatly. But ultimately, you know, they're only using a fraction of all the factory space that they have there. That it's going to take a lot of money to build all the presses and everything else that they need to really swing into mass production of the Model 3. But like you mentioned, they could not have started with the Model 3 because the margins are just too slim. They would have gone out of business a long time ago. And it's only thanks to the dedication of Musk and the rest of the company, and Musk continually dumping more money back in to keep the company afloat, that they've managed to stay alive this far. But you could tell at the event, he was kind of stuttering and stammering. He was very excited to finally show this car to the world. But you could tell this was definitely something that they've been working up to for a very long time. And that was pretty exciting for me to be there, because it felt like being at an Apple keynote, you know, at an old school.
Yeah, but even Apple couldn't get people to get in line 5 years before the product was available. Even Apple can't do that.
And, you know, he also was very good about thanking those who spent 100,000, 80,000, whatever.
Yeah, because we funded
other models. Yeah, you did. You subsidized. Right. You subsidized.
But I think everybody who bought a Tesla in the first few years knew that. That it was very clear that, and I remember talking to people like Jason, who has two Teslas and has an order for a third, that he knows he's spending to make it possible to get to this much more affordable Tesla. That's the goal.
So, right. Leo, if his goal ultimately is to save the world, and obviously he's got a company that he wants to make money with, do you think he's happy seeing something like the Chevy
Bolt? If all Elon cared about was money, he would have retired after selling PayPal.
Right. Yeah. But does the Bolt make him happy? You know, Google supposedly got into Google Fiber in order to speed up internet speeds in the United States, and they've done that. I mean, you know, essentially because of that, both Comcast and AT&T are ramping up their speeds. Is Elon Musk, you think, happy seeing something like the Bolt and the other electric cars that are coming in the pipeline?
Well, I can't read into his, you know, and into his mind. He probably has mixed feelings about it. Remember, let's not forget that there was an electric car industry. GM's, right. What was it, the EV, what was it called, the EV1?
EV1, but even back in the early days of motoring before they...
Well, the first Ford was electric.
You know, because gasoline was this kind of byproduct that nobody knew what to do with, and nobody was really thinking of building an engine out of the thing. So there were steam-powered cars and battery-powered cars, and the first Mercedes-Benz, or the predecessor to Mercedes-Benz, was also battery-powered. So those were, you know, back in the very early days of motoring, there were a lot of EVs. But it just went by the wayside because gasoline was so cheap, nobody knew what to do with the stuff. So they made an engine that burned it, and away everybody went.
Yeah, and so we've tried this before and failed. In fact, there's a documentary that purports to say that the oil industry put the EV1 out of business, that it wasn't lack of demand, although I have the feeling that lack of demand was a big part of it, and lack of charging was a big part of it. So Elon's putting superchargers all around is very much addressing that problem. You kind of started talking about that with the Bolt. You may have a 250-mile range, but basically that range is limited by where you can get electricity.
Right.
And there's definitely been a lot of people asking me, because gas prices are so cheap, do we even need EVs anymore?
Yeah, they won't be cheap forever, right?
Right. There was a lot of cynicism leading into the Model 3 launch that, you know, this thing is going to be a dud because gas is so cheap, nobody cares about EVs anymore.
It's not about saving money.
And all the other things we saw and the encouragement that we got out of this event, that's another big thing that people care about EVs because of more than just cheap gas. So yes, people are excited about this car, not just because it's going to save them money.
It's going to cost me more. I'm anticipating, even though I put big solar panels on my roof, it's going to cost me more to charge up that 90 kilowatt hour Model X battery than it would to just, I don't drive that much, but it's going to cost a lot of money. Electricity in California is not cheap.
Well, but if you have solar on your roof, aren't you going to be?
That's why I put the solar in. Right.
You're going to be having essentially no carbon footprint if you
generate solar. But see, that's the point. I may not be saving money, but I will be very happy to know that this driving around I do is not impacting the world, not even through an electrical power plant that I'm generating.
So if I don't buy, if I decide to bail out on my
you get your money back.
Tesla, get my money back. I'm still thinking about the 2016 Prius. I drive a 2010 now. And my gasoline consumption is so low that it's essentially not an issue either financially or that much of an issue in terms of carbon footprint. So, I mean, we do have alternatives to electric vehicles. Right. And what I love about hybrids, of course, is you can drive forever.
Let me correct my math because Dale Poco's done the math for me. So they've taken in $272 million in deposits. The actual cost, the actual revenue if they sold $42,000 Teslas, that's the average, would be $11.4 billion, not $30 billion. I overestimated it. Although I've seen articles predicting that that'll reach the $30 billion mark before all said and done.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I think quite a few people will be spending a lot more than $42,000 on their Model 3.
Well, boy, you look at the Model X, it starts at $70,000. Good luck getting out the door with that. Incidentally, to answer your question a little bit, and maybe Tim, you can weigh in on this, but how does Tesla feel about, how does Musk feel about the Bolt? In 2014, he opened all his patents, didn't he? And said, you can use any of our patents. I think that's not just lip service. That's saying we want other companies to do this.
Right. And he opened the presentation, the launching of the Model 3. He didn't talk about revenue. He didn't talk about technology, about beautiful design. He talked about emissions and carbon dioxide and global warming. And so that's, you know, his end game is really to help the environment, to help the planet. And if you talk to most of the players who are just now getting into the EV game, most of them say that, you know, the introduction of any new big boat raises the tide for everybody. So everybody gets lifted up by the inclusion of more EVs on the market. So I definitely think that Musk would see more competition as being a good thing because it'll get more people to think about, can an EV fit in my lifestyle? And once they get over that hurdle of thinking that I can deal without a gasoline car, at that point, they start cross-shopping at what else is out there. And, you know, the Model 3 and the Bolt, I think, are very different propositions. I think it's actually really difficult to compare those two cars because, like, comparing a Civic to a BMW 3 Series, for example. But ultimately, you know, those are cars that if you get over that hurdle of trusting the car and trusting the ability to charge it and that you're not going to be stranded somewhere, at that point, you start to look at more interesting options. And the Model 3 is a very interesting option for sure.
In his blog post a couple of years ago when they announced this open patents, he said, it's impossible for Tesla to build electric cars fast enough to address the carbon crisis. Mm-hmm. Our true competition is not the small trickle of non-Tesla electric cars being produced, but the enormous flood of gasoline cars pouring out of the world's factories every day. We believe that Tesla, other companies making electric cars, and the world will all benefit from a common, rapidly evolving technology platform. Incidentally, the deal is if you use their patents, you have to let them use yours. But that's that is, I think that's a great collaborative effort to save the world. I think that's great. I don't have anything.
It's a bit of a shame though that they are building their platform on a proprietary charging standard rather than embracing an industry standard.
Can use an adapter, can't you? I mean, you don't have.
You can use your Tesla in a standard charging system, but you can't use a Bolt at a supercharger, for example. Right. That would not be allowed. And that is unfortunate that they don't at least allow people to pay some sort of a service and be able to use a supercharger station for some other EV. You know, if they really wanted to be progressive about it, I think that would be really the way to do it. And ultimately, that could be a way for them to get a lot more superchargers in a lot more places. You know, if they could become the Mobil, the Sunoco, the Shell of the EV game. I don't think that's what Tesla wants to do, but, you know, I think that would ultimately help drive the industry farther forward than just sharing their patents, which ultimately, you know, GM would rather do their own research than license Tesla's technology, I think.
Yeah. So Larry put down $1,000. Mm-hmm. Dwight, you're going to put down $1,000?
You know, I would love to, but I drive my cars until the wheels fall off. And I bought one 2 years ago. And
You don't need one for a long time.
And so I don't need one. But I am, you know, I am nagging my wife as best I can. And so maybe by the time they're actually available, she'll have been worn down. I would like to have one.
Yeah.
I'm also interested in the Bolt because I like the idea. One of the things I like about the Bolt is that the network of dealers that support it is vast. And in terms of reliability and service, I think it may have a leg up on Tesla. The other thing is that, you know, you can't actually – in Texas anyway is one of those states where the dealers kind of have a lock on it and you can't actually buy a Tesla here. You have to get it shipped to you or buy it online. Mm-hmm. And here being able to walk into any, you know, Chevy dealer and pick up a Bolt I think is very attractive.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty excited about it, but I think and I look forward to someday, God only knows when, getting a Model X. But I actually think that there's some I don't know, and I have no communication from Tesla at all. But my guess is that there's something going on with those X's because they don't seem to be coming out of the factory very
fast. They're definitely having a lot of reliability issues, for one thing, and a lot of consistency issues. You know, everything from panel gaps to, you know, those doors. Musk keeps joking about how they're giving the problems, not just in the engineering side of things, but also in the support side of things. They are having issues with them not closing correctly and throwing faults and that kind of thing. So they're having not only production issues, but also ongoing support issues with those cars. They are ramping up. They're building more now than they were before. I forgot the number. We just saw what they're producing per week. It's getting up there. But
I have my VIN is in the 800s. My vehicle identification number is in the 800s. If they really were producing that many cars, I think I would have gotten one by now.
Did they don't give you any estimate as to when you can expect it?
No.
Wow.
And as you will learn, Larry, there's a privilege to be a Tesla owner or a prospective Tesla owner. And you, what you're really doing, and I think is still true with the Model 3, is you're kind of saying, I want to support this venture because I think it's a good thing. It's like being a Kickstarter guy.
Yeah,
don't exactly. Don't think you're buying a car. You're buying a lifestyle.
Being on the list is as important as being in the car.
And to be honest, Dwight, I think you benefit by not being the first with this. And just wait and see what happens. People who waited for, you know, who didn't buy a Model S but now are buying them are going to get the benefit of all those years. The Model S is pretty consistent and is a great car, and it's a good time to buy a Model S. And you didn't miss out that much by not putting in an order at the very beginning.
And, you know, when you use the word privilege, I think Stuart Alsop would agree with you.
Poor Stuart got his yanked, which is why I'm exceedingly cautious about saying anything about my close personal friend, Elon Musk. he bitched about the last event, right, the Model X event, and how long it took, and he never saw the car. And Elon said, okay, fine, you don't get one.
Yeah, Elon personally pulled his order.
Yikes. Elon, I love you, dude.
You know, Tim Cook has never done that to me.
No.
What I say about the iPhone.
Tim has never invited me to another Apple event, but that's fine.
But you have to take it away, your iPhone.
You just have to understand when you're doing this, and I think Model 3 owners will learn this too, that it's not like buying a car. It's a different experience entirely, including, I mean, look at you bought it without even seeing a picture of it, let alone test drive.
And by the way, they took credit cards. I wasn't planning. I was just driving by the Tesla dealer, and I noticed the line wasn't as long. I saw Scoble had said he got up at 2 a.m. to wait in line, probably at the Palo Alto dealership where I bought mine, and there was hardly any line. So I said, oh, why not? Didn't have a checkbook with me, but they took a credit card.
Yeah.
So, you know, pretty easy.
Yeah.
Took about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Apple Pay?
They do. I think they'll take it. They'll take Bitcoin if you bring it. I'm really thrilled to see this success, and I knew that this was a make or break moment. I felt that it was strongly that it was a make or break moment for Tesla, and clearly they made it. And it's really amazing to me that 250,000 people were willing to order. You didn't really buy it because you can back out of it.
Right. You actually didn't even order it. You actually just—I think you just paid
to get a place in line.
Because, like, I don't know whether I'm going to get the $42,000 version or the $50,000 version. I don't even know yet.
No, you don't get asked that until you get. So here's what happened to me, anyway. You put down your $5,000 for the Model X, and I did that in last fall. And then at some point in January, you get an email saying, "Okay, now order it," and that's when you decide how to configure it, and that's when you determine what's going to cost. And then you have 1 week to configure, and I went back and forth for a long time, And once that week goes by, at midnight on that day, you now have ordered it. And getting your money back or making a change is now a much more complicated process. Mm-hmm. So, you have plenty of time to back out long before you even.
And you can apply it to a Model S or a Model X if you want.
Right.
They made that very clear.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is great. Yep. You may end up wanting to
only another $79,000 in all of Model X.
I think only 3 or 4% of Model X owners have canceled their pre-orders at this point, which is kind of shockingly slim.
No.
So, the expectation, of course, is that carries over to the Model 3 pre-orders, and that's a lot of cars they've sold. It's a very different market, very different car, very different buyer, but, that's encouraging.
That is an interesting question, too, when you think about the fact that there are people who can afford the Model S who are not well-heeled. And it does strike me that it could be a very different buyer experience given the fact it's
high. Oh, you the Model 3? You mean the people who are now going to get the Model
3? Model 3 isn't much more expensive than standard
it's in
car.
It's in that ballpark, sure.
Yeah.
And there may be more backlash. I bet not, though. I mean, anybody who's going to order this without having seen it is pretty much in the club, I would think.
In the bleeding edge. Yeah. Bleeding edge of technology.
Drinking the Kool-Aid.
But Tim, why don't you have you live in the frozen north, so an electric car is actually a bad choice for somebody in the upper New York
State. It's a bit of a bad choice for me. Driving into the city is a bit of a challenge, and there aren't a lot of chargers up here around Albany where I live. But my wife, where she works, actually has EV charging stations, so she's definitely looking to get either a plug-in hybrid, or she had been planning on getting an Audi A3 e-tron, but she went ahead and plunked $1,000 for the Model 3, so I think she's going to wait a little bit longer and see when that comes out. But she's been talking about getting a plug-in hybrid. Being up here out in the country a little bit more, charging stations are harder to come by. So, going into work and back is one thing, but, you don't necessarily want a car that you can only get to work and back in. So I think right now for us, a plug-in hybrid makes more sense. But a year from now, who knows? So she went ahead and hedged a bet and put $1,000 down, and we'll see how things look in a year from now.
Yeah, you might be able to answer a question that my local Toyota dealer can answer. Is there going to be a 2016 Prius plug-in? I haven't seen one.
Yes, there will be.
They just announced those. They look great,
too. The premiere at the New York Auto Show, which was just this past week, actually. It's called the Prius Prime. And it's interesting. The last generation Prius did have a plug-in, but Toyota never really marketed it. They never tried to sell it, and they sold very few of the things. But with the new Prius, they actually gave it not a full redesign, but they put a new nose in the front and a new tail on the back. And it looks a heck of a lot better than the current new Prius, which I don't think I've heard anybody say looks very nice. The Prius Prime doesn't look great, but it is a big step forward. But they didn't give us a price on it, but it will be 22 miles on a charge before it switches over to gasoline. And they're estimating 120 miles per gallon, which is pretty great. So I think they'll sell a lot more with the Prius Prime than they did. 22 miles is a little bit of a disappointment. If you look at things like the C-Max plug-in or quite a few other plug-ins that go closer to 30 miles on a charge, but again, 120 miles per gallon, you can't complain about that too
much.
And
look at the Prius Prime dashboard, which seems very reminiscent of some other dashboard I might have
that's
seen.
An 11-inch
portrait. Did they give a hint as to what they're going to cost?
Yeah.
They did not give us any pricing, unfortunately. And unfortunately, that crazy dashboard is an option, so you'll have to pay a little extra to get that. But it will have Android Auto and CarPlay built in, unless you have other great technology, too.
Good.
That's the car I want right there.
I drove the 2016. I like the ride. It's much smoother than my 2010.
It's a big improvement, yeah.
But I hate the fact it doesn't support Android Auto or Apple Play.
Well, there you go. This is the Prius Prime, yeah.
Yeah, Toyota's bringing that out pretty much across their line, which is encouraging. Android Auto and CarPlay are coming to a lot of cars, and Toyota's definitely making a big push there. So it'll be on there. But again, they haven't said how much we'll have to pay to get the extra batteries for the plug-in version. I'm guessing somewhere in the $3,000 to $5,000 extra range, maybe a bit more. But we'll see.
Yikes.
You know, what's interesting is I see chargers everywhere here in Houston. They're in office buildings.
Yeah.
They're at grocery stores, H-E-B. They are often occupied.
Yeah.
But this is funny. In the apartment complex I moved in 2 years ago into a very high-end – we sold our townhouse. I moved into a very nice high-end apartment complex. And it had two electric car chargers. And they were never used. And about a month ago they took them out.
Oh, no.
They pulled them out.
That I don't get. Why pull it out?
Well, because the parking was at a premium, and people were parking there anyway who didn't have electric cars, so they just went.
We have three chargers in our parking garage next door, but the thing that put me over the top with the Model X was a supercharger in Petaluma.
That's great.
So, but, you know, my feeling is, that, yeah, you see chargers, but as soon as everybody gets electric cars, there's not going to be enough of those. So right. we're going to be fighting over getting to the charger.
Right. I mean, you go to Google and, you know, there's a lot of electric cars in the parking lot.
Our new, I already talked to Lisa about our new facility and whether we could put an electric charger or two there. You can make money on it as a business because you charge $1 an hour. And you know, if it's always occupied, that's $24 a day you're making.
Mm. Beats being a tech journalist.
beats being a book writer, that's for sure.
That's right.
Let's take a break. We'll come back with more. Hey, we got a great panel. Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle, Larry Magid from CBS Radio News, and from CNET's brand new road show at theroadshow.com. Tim Stevens, three of my favorite people. Our show today brought to you by my new blog host. New, not that new. I've been using them for a while, but talking about them for even longer. And I have to say, I love Squarespace. The best hosting, the best designs, the best technology to make it easy to create a unique website that reflects you and your profession, your business, or your personal tastes. Great for a portfolio. The simple cover page means you can at least have a presence on the net that shows who you are. I love it for blogging. That's what I use it for. But they also have e-commerce built into every template. That means you can sell. And boy, is it! It's the best. There is no other e-commerce solution that looks like your. You know, it's not like a afterthought, an add-on. It fits in beautifully. And of course, if you want some help, there are Squarespace designers, specialists who will help you set it up, develop it, even create content for it. And we don't mention that often enough. There really is. Squarespace has become a great platform for everybody. Every design, of course, mobile responsive. That means you don't have a separate mobile site. All sites look great on all size screens. You get a free custom domain name when you sign up for a year. Some new templates, if you haven't been there in a while, go to squarespace.com, click the Get Started button, and try the new templates. There's a grid-style landing page. I'm going to move my site over to that. By the way, that's another nice thing. I have all this content on my Squarespace site. I imported every blog post I've done since 2001. And it's so simple to just change the look. This is my cover page right here. So simple to change the look. You just choose a new template. So I'm going to try that grid-style landing page. The infinite scroll. This is very popular now in a lot. You see this in a lot of blog sites at, you know, places like Vox, The Verge, so forth. You can have related posts appearing at the bottom, encouraging visitors to explore more. An author profile page, which means each of your creators, and you can have multiple creators on a Squarespace site, will have, you know, their own profile. An integrated search field and header. This has really become a true content management system, and I could see a lot of people putting magazines and other online publications on Squarespace.com. Squarespace site never goes down, no matter how many people visit your site. An incredible 24/7 support. Go to Squarespace. Try it today. But if you do decide to buy, all I ask, use the offer code TWIT, T-W-I-T, and that way you'll get 10% off your first purchase, which means what you should do is, you know, get the year or more and, you know, really take advantage of that 10% right now. Squarespace.com. I pay it a year at a time. And I just love it. It's been a revelation to me. Let's talk encryption. The FBI decided to drop their case entirely. They said, hey, guess what? It worked. We got in the phone. So thanks anyway, Apple. We'll see you later. And now we hear, BuzzFeed tells us, that law enforcement around the country is getting messages from the FBI saying, hey, you got any iPhones you want unlocked? We can help. We can do it. We got it. We have the means. Which kind of indicates to me that Apple ain't going to hear it anytime soon what the security flaw is that the FBI has found. There is a whole process that federal law enforcement can go through about whether or not to reveal exploits. Now, of course, in general, it's considered ethically right if you discover a flaw, a security flaw, to report it to the company so they can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I completely understand the FBI's point of view. Hey, we found a way in. We don't have to go back to court. Let's just keep this to ourselves. And meanwhile, we'll call every attorney general in every state, everybody who's got a locked iPhone. And in Manhattan alone, Cyrus Vance Jr., The Manhattan prosecutor says he's got 70 phones himself that he'd like unlocked. So I imagine that that's it, that Apple's not going to learn about it. Is that a bad thing? Should the FBI keep it to itself?
Well, I think this is comeuppance for Apple because they defied IBM and dragged that out for so long. Yeah. It's basically, now that we know, we'll show you. And this is karma.
Well, first of all, Apple, you realize that they can continue to improve their encryption. Now, not knowing exactly how the FBI broke in might be a bit of a hindrance to fix that particular flaw, but Apple is going to continue to improve their encryption. And it was hard for me to judge who won or lost this particular skirmish. On one hand, Apple was able to get off the hot seat, right? The FBI essentially dropped the case, and that's arguably good for Apple. But on the other hand, as you pointed out, it did expose a flaw in Apple's security, which is a problem for Apple. So I think it's a little bit of a draw as to, you know, what Apple comes out of this thing. But they were able to essentially take the upper hand. I think – I don't know if they won the PR battle, but they certainly got momentum on their side. By the time the FBI had made that announcement, the polls were beginning to shift towards Apple. CBS News, New York Times – had done a poll just right before that, and I think it was close to 50-50, whereas the earlier polls, it was much more in favor of the FBI. So I think the FBI, in a sense, miscalculated the public's reaction to this whole thing, and they got themselves a great out once they announced that they found a way to do it without Apple's help.
If we could guarantee that only the FBI would ever know how to do this, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have a problem with it. I mean, I don't have a problem mm-hmm. with law enforcement having access to phones with the appropriate court orders and all that. I mean, I know there are a lot of people who do. They don't trust the government. They don't trust the process. They don't trust secret courts. And I understand that. But given that we live in a nation of laws, I don't have a problem with that. But I do have an issue because as we've learned time and time again, these exploits rarely stay secret. And what if the next person to figure out this exploit figures out a way to put ransomware on your iPhone? Right.
Well, you know, Leo, as you know, I run ConnectSafely.org, and I'm on the board of a national organization that protects children. And a lot of the people who I work with are very much on the side of law enforcement having a back door. But I actually took a position in a column that I wrote recently. It's on ConnectSafely as well as in the Mercury News, where I argue that children are much safer in a world where we have encryption. And that's kind of a counter argument to a lot of the things that law enforcement is saying, that it's not just about security and privacy. It's also about safety. The fact is that these phones expose who we are, where we are, who our contacts are. There's a lot of information and there are health information. And even for children, I think there's something to be said for living in a world where we have tight encryption. And it's very, very difficult to get access to this information. Having said that, I understand your position is if we were absolutely certain that the only people who could ever get access to these phones or this data were law enforcement with proper warrants, proper subpoena, no abuses on the part of government, no risk of it getting into the hands of criminals, foreign agents, you name it, then I'd be okay with it too. But those are some pretty big ifs.
Yeah. Well, history has shown that in general, any exploit will eventually be discovered by bad guys. Mm-hmm. And unless Apple has an opportunity to patch it, what we don't know is what's the nature of this exploit.
There's been some speculation that they were able to get access. I mean, obviously they have the hardware, so you know, getting access to it remotely isn't the question. And there was some speculation that they were actually able to extract it from within the silicon itself.
Right.
And in fact, before. Whoever the third party is, supposedly.
By the way, the third party could even be Apple. We don't know.
Maybe not.
I mean, really, it could be, couldn't it?
But there had been some speculation about a process in which you essentially get into the silicon itself and bypass the encryption, and that there was a theory that could be done even before this company right. came along, and it's possible that that's what happened.
Isn't that kind of what John McAfee was advocating? He had some kind of a scheme that sort of sounded like that.
Encryption is always vulnerable when the key is kept on the device, as Hollywood learned. With the DVD CSS encryption. In order for a DVD player to play back an encrypted DVD, it had to have the key. So when they created the Blu-ray player, they created the option to revoke keys. And as far as I know, that has never been used because unfortunately when you revoke a key, suddenly you break all the Blu-ray players in existence. And unless they can all be updated, you're going to have some very angry customers. So even though that exists, Hollywood's never used it. I presume that there is a similar vulnerability of some kind with the iPhone, that the key must be in some way stored. I mean, the key is your password.
Right, which is all not all of that secure. If it weren't for this automatic 10-time
four digits is even six digits, not very secure, right?
Not for a computer, it isn't.
No, although you can, and bad guys certainly will turn on a long, full, strong password on the iPhone. So the real question is this exploit bypass the four digit, bypass the six digit, bypass the auto erase? What does it do? If it just bypasses the four digit, I think that's relatively harmless. If it somehow allows somebody access to the strong encryption on the phone and access to the data that's been encrypted, it really makes the phone very vulnerable. We don't know. That's the problem. We just don't know. And an exploit can't be limited to the things it can do, right? So that's the problem. I have mixed feelings about this. It's not the end of it. There still is this issue of going dark. This was just one phone, one version of the OS. Apple, of course, is committed to strengthening their OS. They've established that fact, and presumably will continue to strengthen it to the point where they makes it hard for law enforcement to get in. And I think eventually it's going to go to Congress, and the Congress is going to have to make some decisions.
But it's worth pointing out, Leo, that law enforcement in some ways has more tools to access our information now than they did before. They were iPhones and Android phones and BlackBerries. I mean, they've got metadata that they can get through a Google warrant. They've got cloud backup services, which they would have gotten in the case of this phone if they hadn't bungled it by changing the password. They would have been on iCloud. There's all sorts of, there's ISPs that are in the middle. There are internet services like Facebook and Google and Gmail in the middle. So it's not as if law enforcement is entirely in the dark, even with encryption. And that's often forgotten in this discussion. They try to make it sound like, oh my gosh, every tool we've ever had at our disposal has been taken away from us. We're living in a horrible world where the criminals are running amok. That's really not exactly the truth, given the amount of data that still is accessible.
Well, here's an example. This is a case in Arkansas. The FBI has agreed to help in this case. There's a locked iPhone and iPod that belongs to two teenagers who are accused of killing a couple that had raised them as their grandson. and apparently prosecutors believe that there's something in the phone or the iPod that would help them in determining their guilt or innocence. And the FBI has stepped forward and said, okay, well, we'll tell you what's on that phone or that iPod. So the defense attorney was ordered last week to hand over the iPod. It was in the defense's evidence locker. What they I think are going for is recorded phone conversations. There were recorded phone conversations which had indicated that he had communicated his homicide plans on the iPod. So they're looking for text messages or email messages on the iPod. In a case like that,
couldn't they get those messages from the email provider or the text or the cellular company?
Well, unless he was using, who knows? I mean, I use PGP all the time. And, of course, I'm not communicating anything that needs to be private, but I use it just because I can. And so there are a number of people I correspond with. I've got their key. They've got my key. And it's routinely signed by my email client. And that's the real problem is that if you're a bad guy, the means exist.
Right.
Not for these teenagers who are just nitwits.
The terrorists. The serious criminals. Right?
Serious criminals. But there are lots of run-of-the-mill criminals who aren't very sophisticated for whom these kinds of techniques will be very useful. I have such mixed feelings. I just don't know. What we don't want, and I think we all agree, is for the government to do anything that makes us less safe.
Right.
We want all of this is to make us more safe. And if it does something like, crack this encryption and it leaks out, that makes us less safe, then they haven't done their job properly. That's really the issue.
Yeah, I think that's part of the big shame of how this all shook out was that it never really went all the way through. It didn't go all the way through to, you know, all the way to the Supreme Court. Right. It didn't really result in something formal that we could all at least feel was conclusive.
Exactly.
It feels like, if anything, we've just raised more questions on this whole deal than we had at the beginning, which is, you know, the government got what they wanted ultimately, or the FBI at least got what they wanted out of the deal. Apple did not get what they wanted, which was some sort of guarantee for privacy. And certainly a lot of consumers did not get what they wanted, which was an answer of what is the legality of this procedure. And that, you know, means that ultimately the ball just got kicked further down the field. And I'm sure we're going to come to this sort of situation again in the not too distant future, and we'll go through it all over again. Hopefully at some point we will get something concrete and conclusive and in the open that we can all know about, at least, and know what our rights are in this regard.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Apple, April 1st, 1976, Apple incorporates. They are 40 years old. Walt Mossberg did a video where he had all his old stuff. Pulled out all his old
Apple stuff.
Got
a little museum in his office.
What is that, a 2CX, 2CI? It's a portable, the Apple Apple II portable.
That's a
Luggable, really. Well, though, smaller than a compact.
Right. Yeah, no monitor on the front.
Yeah. That's true. There's no monitor, so you have to lug that, too. Oh, yeah, right. Any memories of 1976, you old-timers?
Well, I was a mainframe jockey in 1976.
Really?
I did get an Apple II in 1979, I think.
Wow.
And it was absolutely mind-boggling to have this machine that I could afford to buy, that I could actually carry around if I needed. I wasn't portable, but I moved from Massachusetts to California, and I put it in the back of my car, and didn't need a moving van, and it was life changing. I mean, it literally changed. In fact, it changed my career. I was getting a doctorate in education, which I actually wound up getting, and I haven't had a job in education ever because I was so excited about the Apple II that I wound up becoming a technology writer instead of a college professor. But it was just amazing, and to see how Apple was able to reinvent itself so many times and bring itself literally from the verge of extinction before Steve Jobs came back, I think it was in 1997, if I don't recall, and turn itself into a consumer electronics company, is really a remarkable story that will be remembered. I think as long as we remember businesses, this will be remembered as an amazing company.
Kind of fun, Regis McKenna, who was the genius PR guy who helped Apple get on the map, and not just Apple, Intel and many others, get on the map, has released some of his notebooks from those early days. First revelation is that Regis McKenna apparently owned a rubber stamp that said, "Return to Regis McKenna himself." Which is a bizarre rubber stamp to make, but okay. And in these notebooks, fascinating stuff. I mean, this was his MO. This is how he operated. And so he would take notes, copious notes. Here's a note from a meeting in 1972 with Intel. What is a microcomputer? How do you use it? Typical applications. He's helping them figure out how to create ads like this. How to use, this is 1973. What is a microcomputer? What does it do? How to use it? McKenna was an absolute genius, and hiring him was a brilliant, brilliant move. He met with Jobs when he was 21. In 1976, Woz was 25, took copious notes. Here's a letter from Regis dated June 22nd, 1976, just a couple of months after incorporation. "I met with Steve Jobs at Apple last Thursday in his garage, and then Steve visited our office. He is 21. Along with a 25-year-old partner, Steve has designed, manufactured, and is marketing a microprocessor system. The Apple One computer. His first ad is attached. It will appear in Interface." Remember that? Interface magazine?
Absolutely.
In July. This is just great stuff. Really, this Fast Company had the article.
Yeah, Harry McCracken, I think, wrote that.
Of course, Harry probably kept all of this stuff.
Harry's the greatest.
Harry has become our archivist.
Yeah,
He's a walking museum terms of his knowledge.
Thank you, Harry. Yeah, this is a great article, and thank you for reminding me that this is to give credit to Harry.
And by the way, that first Apple, I think my Apple II, when I finally got it decked out, I bought it with a cassette player at first because I wanted to save money, and then the next day I went and bought myself a floppy disk drive because it was obviously needed it, and then I had to buy a 80-column card because I wanted to use it for serious word processing. And I had to buy a card that allowed me to go uppercase and lowercase because the original Apple II was only uppercase letters. So by the time I fully decked out the machine to the point where it's actually usable, I'm going to want to say almost $3,000.
Yeah.
I think it was about $3,000 for the whole thing.
Which for a long time was the typical price of a computer you could actually
$2,500 was the number, right? The computer you want is $2,500. We used to say that. Now it's $200.
Yeah, really. Right.
Or $5,000.
This was $3,000 $1,981.
You're right.
You know, I have to do the math.
It was money when it was real money. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Here's the first Apple ad that also appeared in Interface magazine with a typo in the very first line. The Apple One system, if a fully assembled, tested, and burned in microprocessor, I think he meant is a fully a typo. And of course, the famous price of the Apple One, $666.66, which Woz thought was a hysterical joke. And it includes, get this, 4 kilobytes of RAM. Wow. Wow. Nice stuff. And there's Ron Wayne's very famous, beautiful illustration of Sir Isaac Newton. It was too complicated to end up using as the Apple logo. It was the first Apple company logo. Ron Wayne only lasted 2 weeks before he said, you guys are scaring me. I got to get out of here. You could get sued and I'd be left with, as the only guy who has anything, I'd be left with nothing. I interviewed Ron Wayne on Triangulation a few months ago, and a great guy who never regretted bailing out of Apple, even though he'd be a multi-billionaire at this point. Really, I'm so did Harry go to Regis McKenna and say, can we copy your notebooks? How did he get these? They're just great and well worth reading. You can click on them to blow them up. Really a fun story.
Look at that picture. That's a great picture.
There's Regis and Steve in early 1980s. Really, really great stuff.
Really a contrast in styles, too, in that picture.
Well, yeah, Steve was a barefoot hippie.
That's right. And a Regis, smelly barefoot hippie.
A smelly barefoot hippie, and Regis was a button-down guy. But I think Steve was aspired to be what Regis was, I think, and learned. One thing Steve Jobs was is a sponge. He learned from everybody he was around. I think he learned a lot from Regis because Steve became probably the best marketer of our time.
What was also amazing about Apple, and I have to say to some extent they've continued this tradition up through the iPhone and the iPad, is creating technology that's actually easy to use. I mean, the Apple II, compared to what preceded it, was so much easier to use than anything. Well, you could argue the Radio Shack Model 1 was comparable, but it really was a breakthrough time. And then, of course, the Macintosh, which came out in 84, was another breakthrough product. And the same could be said, I think, for the iPhone, you know, when compared to a BlackBerry. So they've had a good track record. Whether they'll continue that at this point is anybody's guess.
Yeah, it feels like, maybe not, but it feels like they've reached kind of the end of the innovation line and they're now more evolutionary. Certainly,
it feels that to me. I mean, given the fact that, okay, great, we now have a new, you know, 4-inch iPhone. That's the great innovation of 2016 so far.
And a shrunk-down iPad Pro. Although I bought the iPad Pro. And the iPad Pro itself was too big for me, but the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, is, even with its little keyboard, is exactly what I wanted. I could carry it around with me in my backpack and have it at all times. And it's actually kind of an interesting but it's purely evolutionary, if even that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that Apple – well, Apple stuff is probably simpler. You know, try to find – setting in Windows 10 versus OS 10, it's usually a little easier. But I think when you look at some of the things that they have done in the last 3 or 4 years with iOS, it is so much more complicated and things seem so much more random. You know, hand an iPhone to somebody and tell them how do you do this if they're not familiar with it. And at the early iPhones, you know, you could figure it out pretty quickly, but you have a lot of puzzlement, I think, now. It's much more complex and they haven't figured out, I think, how to mask that complexity with a simpler interface.
They made, a little minute mistake in iOS. When the Apple or the Macintosh first came out, and by the way, if you're an Apple historian or Apple fan, tomorrow on Triangulation, Bill Atkinson will be in studio with
great.
Us.
Oh, wow.
The guy who wrote the ROMs for the original Macintosh, invented QuickDraw, which was a brilliant, brilliant bit of code, and Mac Paint and Mac Draw. But in those days, one of the things Apple did right was they had a very detailed, specific manual for programmers on the Apple user interface. And this is how it must be done. Mm-hmm. This is the right way to do it. One of the things they had, one of the tenets that I really took to heart at the time reading, having read their interface guidelines, was something they called monotony. There should be one and only one way to do anything because the human brain learns that pathway. You don't want multiple pathways. It's too confusing. There are a lot. That's why the one button mouse for so long. There were a lot of things that Apple did right. When iOS came out, they didn't do the same user interface guidelines. And as a result, and I think this is really where the confusion lies, if you're using Apple stuff, you can kind of figure it out. But every app has a different UI. And there's no standard for how you do things. And try and figure it out. The settings sometimes are in the app. Sometimes they're in the settings for the phone itself.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that because I actually find Android in some ways easier to use, which is ironic, right? Because
Google has some much more strict
consistency. Yeah.
Yes, much more strict UI guidelines.
Yeah.
I'm an Android fan, frankly.
I think Google's been more willing to rethink the operating system as well than Apple. Apple seems very, very tied to this idea that iOS is very simple. And so as it adds more and more comprehensive functionality, it just feels more and more tacked on. The notification system in iOS still bugs the hell out of me versus an Android, which is much more intuitive and much more easy to clear notifications out and hide notifications that I don't want or disable them altogether. Things like that in iOS, it just still feels like that's glued on top of the original iOS, which was you know, never meant to have notifications in the first place. I really think that it's time for iOS to be not quite, you know, a clean slate, but ultimately
rethought.
Yeah, because ultimately it's doing a lot more than it was ever intended to do. And to keep adding on more functionality just feels more like a, you know, a square peg getting driven harder and harder into a round hole.
To be fair, though, Android has had the benefit of watching Apple and then following on. Right. So, you know, I would imagine that Andy Rubin and the Android guys are looking at the iPhone saying, you know, these notifications, we need really better notifications. How could we do this right? And so they have the when you're second, you have the option to kind of learn from mistakes made by the guy taking the arrows.
Well, it's funny listening to what Tim was saying about Apple needing to kind of reboot. It reminds me of what happened in 1997 when Apple, when the Mac operating system was getting a little old, and they wound up acquiring Next and getting, you know, getting a lot. I wonder if there's somebody out there who can, you know, another Steve Jobs out there in the wings who can give Apple what it needs for iOS.
Aren't we? This is an interesting question that's kind of always in the back of my mind. Are we ever going to see a new operating system? Aren't we done?
Not for Microsoft. They're just going to keep.
They're just going to keep updating Windows. They basically said that at Build this week that the next version, which they're calling Windows Anniversary of all things, will come out July 2016, and is just an update.
Yep, you're renting it basically.
No more Windows 10. No more Windows. You just we'll just continue to update it. You know, the thing that worries me a little. So I feel like there's no BOS waiting in the wings. I guess is what
Apple has work to do. First of all, on the Mac side, they've got to come up with an answer for Cortana. They've got to put Siri on the Mac. I don't know what's taking so long.
Siri sucks, though. Can I say this?
A better Siri.
Without getting people mad at me, every time. So Lisa uses an iPhone. I use an Android phone. Every time Siri gets it wrong, says stupid things. Siri is it's worse than the product they bought.
Yeah. Well, especially compared to compared to the Alexa. You know, I just bought my third Alexa device. Echo. I have two Echoes, and I have the Tap. I've got the
Echo
the
doesn't do much though. Echo is not trying to do so much.
It turns on my lights in addition to playing music. It turns it locks my doors. I've got it integrated with my Vivint home security system. It does it. And I just wrote a piece that'll come out in Forbes tomorrow morning about the Tap, and my critique of the Tap is that you have to push a button.
Do you have the new Tap?
I do have it.
Has anybody gotten the Dot yet?
Oh, here it is. Here's the Tap right here.
So this is like an Echo that's portable with battery power.
But here's how you have to go. I think, okay, well, I push button. Who is Leo Laporte?
Leo Gordon Laporte is an American technology broadcaster, author, and entrepreneur.
How's the speaker in that? It's
actually pretty good.
Is it?
It's actually not quite as good as the bigger Echo, but it's very close. But the problem is, first of all, there is a little jack in here that I was hoping was a headphone jack.
Yeah.
But it's audio input, which is completely useless. Why would you do that? No audio output.
That's not the speaker I want.
Right. And you've got to push this button, which means you can't say, Alexa, what time is it? Like I can
from
the
across
Echo.
The room. I think
from the next room. I do it from my – I talk to my Echo in my living room, in my kitchen, when I'm watching TV in the living room, I just shout.
We have something like that. It's called Google or Siri or, I mean, but Cortana. We don't need something where you push a button. We want our house to listen to us and respond without pushing any button.
And our car. So, I want a car version of this. I want to be driving my Tesla and just telling it what I want to listen to.
That's
so I can
coming.
Say, you know,
that's coming.
Play KCBS News. You know,
so if you look at the app, if you look at the app for Alexa on the iPhone, I presume there's one for Android.
There is,
you look at the app, there is in there a history of the questions you have asked in audio, so you can actually hear yourself.
And you
going,
can rate it. You can rate how well it. Did it.
That's right.
Respond.
But the other thing is that it is always listening to you.
That's
and listening theory. For its trigger word.
Right.
And, you know, we were talking about encryption and the police and having access to that. If it's always listening.
No. Well, you're misunderstanding that, because the only audio you have here is the audio after you said the trigger word.
Theoretically.
But it's always listening for the trigger word. So suppose.
But it's not smart enough to understand anything but the trigger word. It's just doing matching.
Well, it's not that it's not smart enough. It's not programmed to. If you wanted to get paranoid and
I agree.
Evil.
You have a good microphone in there, and the FBI could go to Amazon and say, "Would you turn on always listening on Leo's Echo? Because we'd like to have a bug in his house."
Yes.
But I would point out that you have microphones all over you. Your phone has the same microphone, right?
Yeah. So except there's no guarantee that the phone is always listening, because you could turn that off. If someone knows you have an Amazon Echo in your home, it is always listening, and you can't turn that off.
No, you can turn it off. There's an on.
No, you can't. You can unplug it just as you could turn your phone off.
Oh, right. But I mean, if you're using it, if it is.
Well, it's
there
the same thing
used.
With your phone. I mean,
yeah. Okay,
if somebody could, I'm pretty much sure that Google could send a signal down to my phone or put some software on my phone that would automatically turn the microphone on and have it on and the camera on and have it on.
It is
right?
on. You go to the home screen of your Android phone and say, okay, Google.
Yeah, I know.
It will respond.
But don't confuse. So here's the difference. Always listening is not the same as sending it back to the home office.
Right.
So I don't care if it's always listening, because all it's doing is churning through the voice pattern to see if it matches the voice pattern of okay, you know who.
Right, and I'm not talking
but
about
I worry there. About it sending it back to the home office, and that it does not do, and although theoretically it could if.
Right.
It could.
And to clarify
something.
I was
looking at what the FBI did with Apple, going to Apple and saying, build us an OS that lets us get in. They could easily do that with other companies.
Yes.
Including.
And may have Apple. Done that.
And may have done it with Amazon, yes.
A number of companies started doing warrant canaries. Apple did one, and Reddit did one, where they say, to this date, no, we have received no national security letters to reveal information about Redditors, except that, and the theory of that is, as long as you see that in their transparency report, that's true. It disappeared this week. So that's a warrant canary, the absence of which means we now know Reddit has received a national security letter. So I love warrant canaries, but we know that this stuff's going on all the time, that companies that receive NSLs are forbidden in many cases from revealing that publicly, which is why they resort to things like warrant canaries. Could very well be Amazon is already turning on echoes for people in their houses. We don't know. We will never know because of the way our secret courts work, which is a shame and a travesty.
See, that's
and of
what
course,
one
Amazon,
of the,
remember, they took encryption out of their tablets, and then they put it back in. Remember, they had a big reaction when they temporarily announced that they were removing encryption, and they put it back. And part of the reason they put it back, I think, is because people were concerned, even though it had nothing to do with the Echo. I think there was a bit of a backlash, given that Amazon is in the business of creating devices that are constantly listening to us, or able to constantly listen to us.
You know what worries me about Apple is that they released a very minor evolutionary and with some fanfare evolutionary upgrade of the iPhone and the iPad, and said nothing about updating their long overdue computer systems. They haven't put Skylake in, for instance, the latest Intel processors, even though most Windows PCs now are available in Skylake.
Or touchscreens.
Yeah.
And I'm scared, because I really like using Apple's products. And they better watch out. You know why? We're going to take a break and come back and talk about the bash prompt coming to Windows 10.
It's right. The year of the Linux desktop.
It's finally, finally here. Our show today brought to you by something that you should be listening to, Audible.com, the best audiobook store in the world. Well more now than 200,000 audiobooks, fiction, nonfiction, periodicals, performances, lectures. I love the great courses. Audible has them all. And if you subscribe, you've got plenty of content that you could put on your phone or your tablet. You can put on, I love it with my Amazon Echo. I say, listen to my book. It starts reading to me. This is a revolution in audio. And we've got a special offer for you. If you haven't tried Audible yet, we've got two free books for you. All you have to do, you're going to be signing up for the Platinum Plan. That sounds good. Is go to audible.com/twit, the number two. Audible.com/twit2. What you're going to sign up for is the two books a month Platinum subscription. You also get the Daily Digest of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times delivered to your phone or your tablet or your Amazon Echo anytime you want to listen. Now, here's the deal. You've got 30 days to try it. If for any reason you don't want it, cancel in the first 30 days. You'll pay nothing. Those books are yours forever. They're yours to keep. But I have a feeling that, like me, I've been an Audible user, subscriber, listener for 16 years. You will find much to listen to. I see Stephen Levy's classic, Hackers, its 25th anniversary edition, is now out on Audible. If you haven't read this book, get it on Audible right now. It is amazing. And as long as you're listening to that, Katie Hafner's fabulous History of the Internet, Where Wizards Stay Up Late, another must-listen-to book. So there are lots of books about technology on Audible. I know a lot of you are into sci-fi. Because they know that you like science fiction, Audible created something they call the Audible Frontiers Program to record audio versions of all the great science fiction classics, books that came out years ago, before audiobooks were even a twinkle in the eye. And I have to say, you know, listening to the Heinlein and the Asimov, and just, it's... this is the best library of stuff. Oh, everybody's raving. I haven't listened to it yet. The Star Wars movie, the novelization. People say if you have questions from the movie, the novelization is awesome. Haven't read it yet, but I do invite you to try it out. Two books free, audible.com/twit2. Subscribe today, and you'll probably be listening to fewer podcasts, but what the hell. Audible, I can survive. Just come back and listen. Look, Tony Tennille, The Captain and Tennille, a memoir. Aw. Audible. See, they got everything. What was Lisa and I were listening to such a great book the other day. This is the other thing I love to do. My wife and I like to listen to Audible books together. Let me go. You know how I know what we were listening to? Because we were listening on the Alexa. I can look at the Alexa history here and see what it was. It was a great story.
We love using the Echo for Audible.
Isn't that cute? Just listening as a couple. Yeah. It's kind of, instead of watching TV. Oh, this is it. The Prettiest One. It's a new thriller by James Hankins. Ooh, it's so good. Yeah, it's fun to listen together. Well, sometimes we'll get in bed and we'll just listen to an Audible book on our Echo.
Is Amazon listening to you as well at the same time?
If it wants to, it's more than welcome. Yeah. The snoring is going to go on all night, Audible. Echo, you might as well just... Audible.com/twit and the number two. Two free books waiting for you. And I love it because every book I've ever bought at Audible is in my library. So I go back often and listen to some of the classics that I bought, you know, in 2001 or 2002. Having a great time on Twit this afternoon. Tim Stevens from The Road Show at theroadshow.com. That's the new... how many episodes do you have now under your belt?
We've done, I think, about six high-end videos and a ton of reviews on some other good stuff as well.
If you want to know about the Model 3, that's where you'll find Tim's great review. And he talks about the event, lots of information, but also the Bolt, also your favorite automotive pranks from April Fool's.
Yeah, we had a lot this year and a couple that were not April Fool's jokes, but should have been.
This is Honda's emoji license plates. I would like an emoji. I think it's just a matter of time. We have emoji license plates in California, right? We have a few different symbols you can use.
Symbols, yeah.
Yeah. Those are okay.
Do the cops write those down if they give you a ticket?
That's a really good question. What do they write? They must have some sort of code. Happy face, smiley face, 365?
I have a feeling that the code is an addition. It's not relevant to how
they leave it out.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know.
A cop.
If there's a California Highway Patrol officer listening, please
let us know.
Lexus had a VLCRO seat. It's the variable load coupling rear orientation seat. It's exactly what it sounds like, a Velcro-covered seat. And you put your kid in Velcro clothing, and they're safe. What did they do that in an ad? Where do they do that?
It was just an April Fool's joke video where they had some. I mean, for a race driver, it actually kind of almost makes sense. But yeah, that was another quote unquote funny April Fool's joke.
Oh, so it wasn't a child safety seat; it was a race car safety seat.
Did you see the Google self-driving bicycle video that they did?
Self-driving bicycle.
Yeah, it came out of Google in Amsterdam. It was hysterical.
Google used to. Yeah. It almost felt like for a while that's all Google employees did all year long is prepare for April Fool's.
Yep.
That, I think, is changing. They haven't been doing as many. And after their mic drop April Fool's Gmail prank, I don't think they're going to be doing a lot more.
Yeah. Which would be okay. It seems like they went overboard a little bit.
Yeah.
I think they've been going overboard a little bit with the Google logos every day, too, in my humble opinion. But this one blew up in their faces a little bit, so maybe they'll rethink things.
I couldn't figure it out. What was funny about it?
So,
what did I miss?
So we didn't see it on the West Coast because it was so horrifically a failure that they killed it before we woke up. But maybe you saw it, Tim. What happened?
Basically, there was a button in Gmail that you could click to add a GIF of one of the Despicable Me helper dudes dropping the mic and turning away, and that would be basically be your email, and that would be it. And it was really easy to click that instead of the send button. And so someone mocked up an email in which they were replying their condolences about someone's death, I believe it was, and they clicked that button incorrectly, and so it was a mic drop. GIF, which is not exactly a nice message.
Well, it was easy to, as you can see if you're watching the video, the way Google's always done it on Gmail, you have a send button and then to its right a send and archive button. They replaced the send and archive button with a send and mic drop, but it doesn't say mic drop. It just has a kind of a obscure icon of what is obviously, once you know, dropping microphone. Right. Many people who are in the habit of hitting send and archive just hit it. So two bad things happened. First, your serious email has a minion in it with an animated GIF with a minion dropping a mic. But, I didn't experience this, but apparently you could also not respond to that email. It basically prevented replies, or you would never see the response because it's a mic drop, right? I'm done. I've said everything I'm going to say.
And there was a bug where if it didn't go through and you sent another email after that, that email would have the mic drop.
Oh, my God.
And so there were some emails that went out with the mic drop that weren't supposed to have them.
Terrible.
April Fool's on the internet, was kind of funny for a while, but so often the jokes don't work and they're just more annoying than funny. And it's, it's that old line about dying is easy, comedy is hard.
Yeah.
And, and it's just, I can do without it at this point.
Did you guys get a memo telling you not to fall for April Fool's jokes that people would?
Did CBS send that out?
Yeah, apparently. Something went around the newsroom, just basically.
Just a reminder.
Reminder, watch it if somebody pitches a story.
The worst is getting like a half a dozen pitches from random PR agencies saying, hey, look at this hilarious April Fool's joke that my company is going to be doing tomorrow. I'll give you the information under embargo if you'd like to write about it. It's like, no, I don't want to write about your April Fool's joke.
No.
In fact, I want you to take me off of whatever list that you
found. Stop now. Some wag said April Fool's is the only day of the year where people don't believe everything they read on the internet. I kind of like the Google cardboard plastic prank, though. Did you see this one? This was just a video, and it's a new VR helmet that is lightweight, immersive, because it gives you real reality. It's just clear plastic, and everything. It's waterproof, 360 degree sound, works with all apps. Okay, this was kind of funny.
Yep,
kind of funny. Analog clock, which is a wristwatch. all right, but enough April. We managed to survive April 1st one more time. Thank goodness. We did get and this is no prank. Oh, by the way, I forgot to point this out. Larry, you put your review of the original Macintosh. The LA Times reviewed the original Macintosh.
Yeah, show the yellow screen. That's hysterical. Dwight, you'll recognize what that looks like, an old yellow newspaper.
Newspaper does not last very long. It's not designed to. It yellows. But it's nice that you still have this, and even nicer still that you saw it as a winner.
I did. I as you can read, I rarely get excited over a new computer. That's still true, but that really was an amazing moment.
Oh, man.
And there's a line in there about how Apple's young chairman, Steve Jobs, showed me this new computer.
How nice. How fun.
It was fun, yeah.
The first time
there
I
is.
Saw
Apple's
Mac.
Apple's young chairman, yeah. I'll blame the company,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The first time I saw a Mac, I was at a party in Austin, and it had been out maybe about a year, and I had yet to see one. And I went into it was in the bedroom of this house where the person was having the party, and I was so mesmerized by it, I went and I locked the bedroom door and spent the entire evening out of the party playing with this Mac.
Oh, man. Wow. And, just the beginning.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I was like,
and,
oh, my God.
And many years later, Dwight, you wrote a book on helping Windows users switch to Mac. I mean, that was not right after you.
Yes,
you
and running Windows on the Mac. I did two of those. And, and it, you know, it was funny. The first time I saw an Apple computer store, because Apple actually had these affiliate stores when the Apple II came out. I remember I was at a laundromat doing my laundry, and there was one open across the parking lot. And I thought, why would anyone want a computer in their home? That was my first reaction.
Who's that?
That's from The Verge. It's Dieter Bohn.
Oh, Dieter Bohn of The Verge. Well, here's a picture of Larry Magid with his Apple II in 1981. What a good-looking fella, Larry.
Last time you saw me in a suit, I believe.
That is a great picture. And apparently they flew the – I like this. Apple flew the pirate – I'll have to ask Bill Atkinson about it tomorrow on Triangulation. Flew the pirate flag over their headquarters. Of course, the pirate flag was the flag Steve Jobs very famously flew above the Skunk Works that was developing the Macintosh in the face of a lot of opposition from John Sculley, the CEO, and the shareholders and Apple II lovers who were afraid that the Macintosh would cannibalize the Mac.
Was that the original flag that they were flying there? Did they fish that out of the closet and fly the original one?
That's a good question. It's got the rainbow Apple logo, which means, you know, it's not the current Apple logo. That's a really good question. Wow. Somebody must have that.
Forever. You know, when the Apple II people would fight back to...
They had a conference, I remember that, in San Francisco called Apple II Forever, right before they killed the Apple II.
That's exactly right.
But if you remember, and if you saw the Steve Jobs movie, which was, of course, historically insanely incorrect, but I think it's somewhat true that one of the reasons Jobs got fired from Apple was because he basically was killing the Apple II with a new computer that wasn't going to sell and was cost way too much money. I remember looking at the Lisa at the store thinking, $10,000, I'm not buying that. But when the Apple II came out, $2,500 seemed so much cheaper. I mean, the Mac came out, then I ran out and got it. We've looped in on ourselves. I apologize. Let's talk about
it's like
Nest.
An infinite loop.
It is. One infinite loop. a little battle between the Nest folks and the Dropcam folks. Former Dropcam CEO said Nest should stop blaming Dropcam for its bad results. We're the only thing that saved Nest. And then Nest saying, screw it. Anyway, Nest struggling because we now see the results. After spinning out all of its companies, Google companies, into the Alphabet companies, now these companies' results are not hidden under Google's results, and we're starting to see some trouble in paradise. The Nest is not selling well. The hardware chief, Shiga Honjo, and Scott Mullins, the senior engineering manager, are leaving the company. Maybe leaving the country, too. I don't know. Nest is underperforming. Now, $340 million in revenue doesn't sound terrible, but they were Google was hoping for $500 million. They did, don't forget, pay $3.2 billion for Nest in 2014. Trouble in paradise? Why is the Nest not doing so well? Is it over for Nest?
Well, they finally kept up with the smart home trend. I mean, we've been talking about how great Alexa is and all the great things that does, and there's no reason that the Nest couldn't be doing the same exact thing. You know, it's got ties to Google technology. It's got ties to everything that you need. It could be tied into your, you know, Google One and Google Now and everything else. But instead, it's just still a thermostat that ties to a smart smoke detector and a few other things, and that's about it right now. You know, they had a huge leap, a huge advantage over all these other smart home devices, and they've kind of stayed stagnant for the past 12 to 18 months, and that's way too long.
I had Nests. I had two Nests in my old apartment when we moved. I didn't bother connecting them up. I didn't see any real value to it.
See, that's how I feel about it. I mean, a thermostat, okay, what does it do? It has a network connection. Is that really a big deal? So I just had Vivint put in, for review purposes, this home security, home automation system for me. And they offer the Nest at a premium price, but they have their own thermostat that's controlled by Z-Wave, and it's pretty simple. I can't figure out why I would want to spend extra for a Nest.
$250, right?
I mean, it just doesn't, I just can't get it. I mean, even this one is overkill, because I can remotely adjust the temperature in my house over the internet. And even that's something, after trying it out, I never actually would normally do, because a regular thermostat does a pretty good job. So, and even the smoke detectors, there are others on the market besides Nest. They don't have anything that they don't have anything proprietary in terms of what they accomplish.
Well, there's a lot of competition in all of those areas.
Mm-hmm. And at least in the Vivint product and some of the others, it's an integrated system. So it does everything. It locks the door. Right. It turns lights on and off. And there's all these rules you can set on your phone.
Yeah, but who needs it?
Well,
really, right?
I like being able to unlock my front door without having to use a key. I mean, I
worry about that.
Well, you worry about it. Yeah, I worry about that too.
Yeah. Of course, the battle between Tony Fadell, the CEO of Nest, he gave an interview to The Information disparaging Dropcam. So Greg Duffy, the guy who founded Dropcam and sold it to Nest in 2014 for $500 million, wrote a post on Medium this week saying, "I would almost find such blatant scapegoating amusing if it weren't so insulting to the team. Given that, I feel now these are two people working at the same company. Given that, I feel compelled to set the record straight. Just before we were acquired, Dropcam was in the middle of a record year of sales, had a 4.5-star best-selling camera on Amazon, was rolling into large brick-and-mortar retailers with huge merchandising support, had innovative new products imminently launching, still had most of its financing in the bank, and our investors and team actively didn't want to sell. It was my mistake to sell." But that's a story for another day. Ooh.
Oh.
Trouble in paradise. Or maybe it isn't paradise after all. maybe it's not so so great as after all. We knew this would happen. I mean, it's one of the reasons they spun off into Alphabet, right? Is so that companies couldn't hide under the Google umbrella so much.
Right.
Companies would have to rise and fall on their own merits.
Which is a bit of a shame, because that's part of the joy of Google, you know, is all those Project X's, all those X Lab projects that were so great. And you knew we weren't making any money and weren't going to be making money for 2 years or maybe even 5 years or maybe even longer. But they were doing really cool stuff. And, you know, we see Boston Dynamics now moving away. And you know, Boston Dynamics was doing amazing stuff. You know, self-driving car research, that's not going to make Google any money for a long time. Alphabet, I should say, not going to make them any money for a long time. So that's, I think, a little bit disappointing in terms of the way that they've ultimately fragmented the company. And, you know, I'm curious to see what the net result is down the road. It certainly makes them a more sophisticated company, and certainly if you are a more conservative investor, I think it makes the decision a little bit easier for you. But in terms of, you know, all these great moonshot projects that we all love Google for doing, it definitely makes that a harder proposition.
I was talking to Brad Sams. We had a meetup at After Build on a Friday. It was a really great meetup. Everybody who was there, thank you for showing up. A lot of fun. Brad Sams was there. He's the editor of Therat.com and Petri. And he said his theory with Google is the problem Google has, and it's probably a problem that Alphabet has in general, is that engineers are allowed to move on to whatever project interests them. And so it's very easy for Google to launch exciting new things, a lot harder for them to keep the team together after it's launched, because then the innovators go, okay, what's next, and move on. And meanwhile, they've got, you know, Wave or Google Plus or whatever, when nobody wants to work on it because it's done. And so nobody maintains it, updates it, and so Google's ADD problem, which is very obvious, really comes from that.
How many great services have they killed over the years? I remember they launched a Google Pay credit card where you could basically aggregate your credit cards together into one credit
card.
And they just killed it this past weekend, which, you know, I had one. I never used it, to be honest with you. But, that's a cool idea that could have been great that Google launched and never put any muscle behind, and then it died. I'm really still nervous that Google Voice is going to go away.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I'm dependent on Google Voice. It's the only phone number I give out. I love it, but I worry that it's going to go away at some point. And I wonder about Project Fi too. You know,
there's a little, you know, there's indication that you might be right, because when you get Fi, I use Fi. Fi is great, by the way. It's the least expensive service I use
for traveling, especially overseas.
Yeah. Because you get free unlimited calls and texts, and the data you pay as you go, and it's very, you know, it's $10 a gigabyte, but they do fractional. And when you're overseas, you get free slow data, free unlimited international texts, and 20 cents a minute phone calls. It's T-Mobile's same service.
But here's the one thing that's cool about Fi. So I have a Fi that I keep on pause because I only use it when I'm traveling overseas.
Oh, you can do that?
I don't. So I just pause it. I can do it on the app. And then when I go overseas,
brilliant.
I activate it and pause it when I get home.
But when you went to Fi, you had to port your Google Voice number over to it or have it discontinued.
Or create another Google account, which is what I did.
Yeah.
I have a separate Google account.
So I ported my number over. So you had to create it under a separate Google account.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm worried that now it's a Fi. Now, in fact, if you go to voice.google.com, now you get redirected to Fi. But at the very bottom, in fine print, there's a link to Google Voice where you still have all the Google Voice features you used to have, but you have to find it.
And is Fi open to, if Fi is open to anybody now, right?
It is. But you have to buy the Fi phone. And when you buy a Nexus phone, then you can sign up for Fi.
Right.
Yeah. Well, those are good phones, the 6P, the 5X, the Nexus 6. They're decent phones. Not as good, in my opinion, as the S7. To me, this is the phone of the year. So
my S7 is embedded permanently in my
in your Gear VR.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, how'd you get the Gear VR that fits the 7? Is that the generic one?
It fits. Oh.
Is that the old S6 one?
No, this is as far as I know the current VR, but it fits the X7.
Shouldn't be the one you get.
Yeah, they released the VR with the
S6.
Yeah, but it's you know how it works.
I guess it would fit.
It's the same size.
Plugs in here. Like that.
Yours is coming there for the big one.
Yeah, I got an email from them saying it's coming, but it's going to take a long time. If you want your money back, you can have it.
Yeah, the latest version has a notch that you can adjust for the size of the phone.
Okay.
Right, and then you can snap right in.
Oh, I don't have that version. I have the S6 version.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You have the fixed version.
Right. I don't have the notch. Well, I'll get the notch someday. I like the Gear VR, but I don't need it no more because I got an Oculus Rift. We're going to take a break and talk about the Oculus Rift in just a bit. Our show brought to you today by FreshBooks. If you're a small business owner struggling with your taxes, it's April 15th soon. Be advised that freaking out and burying your head in the sand will not solve your problems come April 15th. What will help? You got to bring a little FreshBooks into your life. FreshBooks. I remember when I first started using it in 2004, and it's gotten better and better and better. It really saved my life. It makes it easy to create invoices, keep track of your receivables, know who's paid, when, who hasn't paid. FreshBooks also makes it easy if people don't pay or are slow to pay because they make those notifications, little emails that you send out. They do that automatically. That's why, on average, FreshBooks users get paid 5 days faster. They also save a huge amount of time on paperwork, and come tax time, they can zen their way through it. Even if you use an accountant, your accountant will love the FreshBooks reports. All your details in one place. The mobile app lets you take pictures of receipts and organizes them for later, which makes claiming expenses at tax time a breeze. You can even set up FreshBooks to import expenses directly from your bank accounts. They just announced their EMV chip card-enabled card reader, which means you can now, a lot of people use FreshBooks who work, you know, at people's houses, like, you know, set up their audio system, or plumbers, or, you know, and house inspectors. Bring your FreshBooks, make an estimate, get the client to accept the estimate. When you're done, put the invoice right on your phone, and then you pop in the card reader and they pay, all without leaving the app. It's already popular to IT professionals, people who do home computer repair and maintenance, all the trades. So awesome. Best part about using FreshBooks is the feeling that you'll have when tax time does come around, and you got it. Now, probably too late for this year, but for next year, try it. FreshBooks.com/twit. 30 days free. Go to FreshBooks.com/twit. And when they ask you how you heard about it, would you please tell them you heard about it on This Week in Tech so that we get the credit? It's our great sponsors that make all of our shows possible. And it's important that they know that you heard it here. FreshBooks.com/twit. That's even more important now. They're turning this into a brewery, believe it or not. Just what Petaluma needs, another beer brewery. They're turning our studio into a brewery. The designers were walking through the other day.
Knowing that, I will come in and do it.
Well, we found a new place. It's the same size. We could take everything with us, but it's just moving that. We don't even have to redesign it. It's $500,000. So these sponsors make that possible. So thank you, FreshBooks. I really, really appreciate that. One thing we'll definitely be taking with us is our Oculus Rift. We'll talk about that in just a second. But first, I made a little movie for you about all the fun we've been having this week on Twit. Take a watch.
Previously on Twit.
We have spent more than $5,000 building the ultimate virtual reality gaming machine. I'm going to throw up. this is way too realistic.
Security Now.
I introduced a new piece of freeware. Never 10 offers an easy way to put the freeze on Windows 10.
Can I just congratulate you on excellent marketing? Because that name is half the reason you're getting links, I'm telling you. It's time for Windows Weekly, the Build Edition. Hey, everybody.
They're only here because Mark Rozinovich isn't speaking right now, but thanks for coming.
Let's talk about HoloLens.
I feel like it's got better, but it's still definitely field of view issues.
This Week in Google.
Do I have rights to privacy when I walk down the street?
No, but now think about the Google self-driving car. It's not just mapping the world in 3D and in a point cloud. It's watching you. This is a scary amount of new data that we haven't
thought through. You cannot legislate around the emotion of scary or creepy. I don't like clowns. Let's outlaw them.
Oh, that sounds like a good one. I'll sign up for them.
This is your brain. This is your brain on Twit. Any questions?
It was VR week here, absolutely. But let's take a look at what's coming up next week.
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here's a quick look at a few things we'll be following in the upcoming week. And, to be honest, it's a pretty quiet week. But we have a couple of notable things. First, Y Combinator's third annual Female Founders Conference happens on Monday, April 4th in San Francisco. The event aims to empower women to become successful founders by just basically putting them in touch with those who have done so already. And on Tuesday, April 5th, the VR platform wars continue as HTC Vive begins shipping to customers. With the commercial release of Oculus Rift this past week, this obviously means that consumers more or less have a choice. So it'll be very interesting to see which platform reigns supreme. No doubt there will be plenty more for Megan Moroney and I to discuss all week on Tech News Today, every weekday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern at twit.tv/live. That's a look at a few things we'll be keeping an eye on the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Jason Howell. Megan Moroney, Tech News Today, every Monday through Friday. I didn't realize the Vive is due out so soon. I have one of those on order, too. I will have, by the end of this, two Oculus Rifts and a Vive. And I guess I'll have to buy a PlayStation 4 and get one of them, too. This is
and a HoloLens.
And a HoloLens, $3,000. Those came out this week as well. Clearly, and that's AR, but I think AR and VR are kind of hand in hand, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a gimmick, or is this really going to make a difference?
Well, as I was telling you, Leo, I had a lot of fun. I didn't go out and spend even $1,600, which is kind of the minimum you need to spend for a PC and an Oculus Rift. But I went over to Facebook the other day, and I spent some time playing with it. And as I mentioned earlier, I've been playing a lot with this much less expensive VR gear. And I enjoyed it, but as somebody who's not a heavy-duty gamer, it is not something that I would be willing at this point to invest a lot of money and time into. It's more like an experience. I mean, I almost wish there was an arcade you could go to and pay a couple of bucks every once in a while to play with it. Maybe you can set that up as a business in your new facility. Because I just think that the average person is not going to get a lot of value out of it immediately. I think schools eventually can make incredible use of it. I can see lots of training, education, again, arcade kind of styles. But In terms of something that people want to have in their home, not at that price point, not quite yet.
It is very expensive. I mean, although here's a data point you might want to keep in the back of your mind. Ryan Trout, who helped us build this kind of ultimate virtual reality gaming machine from PC Perspective in our This Week at Computer Hardware show, has built a kind of minimal machine that fits the minimal requirements of the Oculus Rift, as well as a fancy machine like this. He says that the experience is indistinguishable. And he says that's probably because developers, at least early on, are not writing for the high-end hardware. They're writing for the guaranteed minimum. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, John Slanina, our studio manager, is playing with it right now. It's been pretty much constant use since we unboxed and set it up earlier this week. It's fun. But you're right. It's expensive fun. I paid a lot of money for that privilege.
It's also, I think, still, it's cumbersome. It has, to me, I have played with some of these, and it strikes me as the as being like the 3D glasses for home television. You know, I don't think the average person wants a face hugger on their head. And I think that until it is lighter and smaller and maybe done in such a way that you don't actually need the the box on your face, I don't think that the average person is going to be very interested in this.
Yeah.
Even for entertainment, a lot of people who are using it say that, you know, this would be a breakthrough for motion pictures as well as for games. And I'm not sure I see that.
And also,
it's also a very isolating experience, which is a different thing. You know, I love lying down on the couch and watching a movie with my wife, or we play co-op video games together, that kind of thing. You can't really do that in VR, at least not yet. You know, there will be co-op multiplayer games for sure, but even if you're sitting in the room with someone playing VR,
you're isolated, right?
You're on your own, right. Yeah. And so that, right, I think, is going to be a big hurdle as we're moving beyond these initial gaming experiences. But definitely, I also agree that education is a big thing. I mean, getting kids out in the country to a major zoo somewhere is a difficult thing. You can plop them down the middle of the Serengeti if you want to through an Oculus headset. But again, for those experiences, I don't think you necessarily need a $600 Oculus Rift. A Gear VR would be more than adequate to do that kind of experience. And I'm actually really encouraged to see what kind of educational experiences come out of these VR systems, especially the ones that cost, you know, $100, $200.
Well, the other thing nice about the Gear VR and also, of course, the Google is that it's self-contained. I mean, you need the phone, but you're not tethered.
Right.
And part of the problem is you've got to be tethered to a PC with the Oculus Rift. But I think that we're going to see some standalone VR headsets in the $200 to $300 range that are going to make a lot more sense for your average consumer than a $600 goggles along with a $1,000 or more computer. But again, we're early in this, so it's great that they're able to make these investments and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, we were early in this in the 90s when it first appeared and then vanished. Right. And yeah. And there's a reason
this is
why
not
that
the
happened.
First iteration, is it?
Right, right.
And
right.
Actually, you used to work at a VR arcade back in the mid-90s. That was one of my first jobs. So, you know, you mentioned charging a couple bucks for it. That's exactly what I was doing back in the 90s in that wind bus. So,
my first experience was at Epcot Center in 1994. I got a magic carpet ride, and I was blown away.
Oh, yeah. And, I remember that.
And my favorite experience so far on the Oculus Rift, I don't know if you've done it, Leo, is the Eagle Flight, where you fly over Paris and you fly under the bridge. And
no, I don't even know if we have that one.
Oh, it's great. As a former pilot, I mean, it gave me a lot of the same thrill I used to have when I used to fly real airplanes without the cost and danger. So, I think that's an amazing experience. The other thing that was really fun is one thing they do with the Rift that you can't do with these portable ones, including the VR, is that it has a way of sensing your body position, not just your head position. So when the dinosaur walked up to me in one of the games I was playing, I was able to get under it and look at the dinosaur from the bottom, the top,
that's kind of cool.
Sides.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I actually literally felt like I'm touching it. And I don't know if you had the experience of there you go. There's the Eagle Flight. Have you had the experience of standing on top of a tall building and actually being afraid?
That one I did, and you can walk right up to the edge and look down, and it's a little bit vertiginous.
I could not bring myself to actually step over the edge because viscerally, even though I knew I was in a room, viscerally I felt like I was on the edge of a building. You know,
what would have happened if you did?
Nothing. Of course, I was. I knew that intellectually.
No, but what would you see? What's the experience they give you when you do that?
I didn't have.
Well, here you got to look at this. This is a Japanese VR game called what is it? Save Walk the Plank and Save the Kitten. So the idea is, and this is going to be in arcades. The idea is you're wearing a Vive and headphones. You've got the touch controllers. And you see, these people are actually in a room on a plank. There's no risk to them whatsoever, but they're terrified because what they're seeing is a kitten. let me back up a little bit. A kitten on a plank projected over, you know, like a very deep, you know, you're a skyscraper. And so the experience is vivid for them of they are in a risky position. And even though intellectually you know that you're safe.
That looks amazing.
Doesn't that look like a fun game? Yeah. It looks terrifying to me. I don't know if I want to play it or not.
Let that kitten go. It's not worth it.
Go ahead, kitty. Enjoy. The kitten's going to come back.
Just kidding. No real kittens have been harmed by this.
The kitten is going to come back. I don't think the kitten's as dumb as humans. Yeah. Right. No, you don't want... So, John, do you feel... Now, you were just playing the Lucky's tale. It's kind of... It's immersive enough that you feel like you're in the event, right? Yeah. In the game.
It was weird. It was very weird.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I feel like this... At least for gaming, that this is a breakthrough product.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
And it is too expensive. But in some ways, I regret that they're... Now, Chris, our intern, is playing with it. I regret in some ways that people have experienced cardboard and Gear VR, which is not as rich as an experience, to be honest with you.
Right. One thing that you don't... VR will crack things open quite a bit because, you know, the cost of entry is a lot lower there, and the developer support is bound to be huge once those things get out there. And also, the Move controllers are quite inexpensive.
Right.
You know, Oculus doesn't even have their motion detecting controllers in the market at all.
And you need that. I think you really do.
For a long time.
You want to reach out.
It definitely changes the game. Yeah. I played the London Heist game, which is one of the demos that they have for PlayStation VR, and you actually, you know, you had to crack a safe and open drawers and pick up a gun, and it's a really different feeling to actually, you know, hold your hand out in front of you and aim down the sights as you're shooting someone. That's a very different experience than just hitting the A button on an Xbox.
But we need you try one of these out. This is the Google hardware, but the New York Times included it in the Sunday subscription. And I was actually disappointed when I was watching a New York Times video of an airdrop in, I think, the Sudan. And I was watching this video, or I was watching the immersed in the VR, and I saw the package drop, but I forgot to look up. I didn't know to look up at where the drop was. And I was thinking about this, as if I were watching this as a movie, the director would have seen to it, a traditional movie, right? The director would have seen to it that all the important information was in my field of view. But because this was virtual reality, I was in control of essentially where the camera was pointing, and I missed a very important aspect of it. And I think that if you're going to use VR for storytelling, you have to really think about how do you prompt the user to look in the right direction.
Right. I think that's something that these directors will learn to do as this VR kind of goes forward. We've heard about Spielberg being really excited about VR and looking into it. And we've done some experiments in VR. We shot a couple of car reviews in 360 video, and we did a floor tour at the Geneva Motor Show in 360 video. And you really have to think about how exactly you're framing it. We've got a lot to learn, too, from our end. I can only imagine what a Hollywood producer has to learn. But, you know, video game designers and developers, for example, have learned to put bright colored objects in the path that you need to follow so that it kind of catches your eye as you move forward. You can imagine Hollywood designers doing the same sort of thing and having, you know, little keys and little indicators that are subtle, but enough to get you to know, you know, it could be an audio cue or something that you need to look left, you need to look right. And certainly, hopefully, you don't ever have to turn around in your seat because that could get pretty uncomfortable.
Microsoft's HoloLens became a reality this week. People who spent $3,000 for the developer edition will start getting their HoloLenses soon. And AR is different from VR, but but it also similar. And I think part of of course, if you covered your eyes with an augmented reality headset, it'd be just like VR. I feel like both of these are very important technologies. These are new platforms, aren't they? I mean, that's you know, we just showed you it was $2,500 for the first Macintosh. You know, it was, of course, these are expensive initially. I agree with you. PlayStation 4 is going to be the breakthrough product, probably.
Yeah, I think so. HoloLens is hugely exciting from a future perspective. I hope it doesn't take 30 years for that to get as affordable as a modern PC is now compared to an original Apple II or Macintosh. HoloLens right now has a lot of issues where it's not really ready for consumer adoption, I don't think. But I can't think of anybody who wouldn't be excited with the prospect of being able to put on a pair of glasses that look a little bit less silly than that, and having a fully immersive experience projected onto your eyeballs, effectively, you know, over top of the world around you. That also would help with the idea of this being an isolating experience. You know, if you can see through this thing, you could be experiencing some sort of virtual reality experience.
There are also some interesting commercial applications. Like, for example, you know, you look through the IKEA catalog and you see a couch. Well, okay, great. We know what it looks like in a showroom. What would this couch look like in my living room? And you could actually do that. You could sit in your living room wearing your AR glasses and see that couch superimposed in your home. And there's some huge medical and educational industrial uses. I think from a practical standpoint, AR is way, way ahead of VR. From an entertainment and gaming perspective, VR is obviously more fun, I think. But I think there's a lot that we're gonna benefit from augmented reality.
Well, and I think gaming, I'm actually more excited about gaming with the HoloLens, because I would rather interact with the real world around me and then have that augmented for a game. I mean, to me, that's like that is where you'll get some real imagination coming in. I think you'll see games that you haven't even thought of before and have not seen anything like in traditional gaming or in VR.
You know, it's funny. What do they call those arcades where you walk around with guns and they're dark rooms? What am I? I'm blanking
laser,
the name.
Laser tag.
Okay. Yeah. Imagine playing laser tag with augmented reality with real people. That'd be amazing.
Yeah. There's actually a concept video of someone who wants to create a laser tag-like experience in a warehouse, but with VR glasses. So you'd walk up to a wall and you'd feel a wall, but it would actually be, you'd see, you know, this crazy tunnel inside of a spaceship or something like that. And so, you know, mixing an actual experience together with a virtual reality experience to create this sort of, very well done, to create this amazing sort of combined experience where you're actually walking through a very simple experience, but you're seeing something amazing. And that is, I think, a very exciting next generation arcade sort of thing. I would pay a good amount of money to go run around and shoot my friends and that kind of thing.
In a week, you'll be able to go to a movie theater and watch a movie called Hardcore Henry. You guys familiar with that?
Yeah.
This is interesting because I feel like this is the creators getting ready for this new virtual reality future. The idea is it's an action thriller, but it's shot in the first person. You are Henry. Mm. And I don't know what this is going to be like in a movie theater, but everything that in the movie is first person.
It looks absolutely awesome, potentially a little bit nauseating, but I think they've already said that the sequel, which they have to make because there's so much buzz about this already, that the sequel will be in VR, which is awesome and exciting. But yeah, I mean, the tricks that they had to pull off to make this movie work.
Is a VR movie without a helmet. Basically.
The question is, are you willing to wear a helmet for 2 hours to watch a movie? Are you?
I've worn. So let me tell you, when you play one of these games, it's so immersive. I could see you spending all day in these. The Oculus is not uncomfortable. And with a good, by the way, they've really improved the audio. So the sound is excellent.
And not that you don't get that with this. The sound is horrible. Yeah. It's great.
So I really feel like 2 hours is not going to be that much to ask for. You're going to forget you're in this thing. That's what happens to me with the Oculus Rift. You very quickly become acclimated to the idea that you're in this thing, and it becomes scarily real.
Yeah, I'm super excited. Like I said, back in the 90s when I worked at that VR arcade machine, I thought that was the future. You know, I couldn't wait until
Why did it take off then?
There just wasn't the technology at the time. The latency was really low. You know, those virtuality machines that they had in arcades cost $20,000 to $30,000. They were running like 16 networked 486s together to give you the kind of graphics power that you needed back then. There were VR headsets that were at home that weren't, you know, all that much more expensive than an Oculus is today, but, you know, they were VGA at best, and it was just a really poor experience. And then everyone, when that failed, everyone wrote off VR altogether. And it was really thanks to Palmer Luckey, the individual who was, you know, a VR nerd who had, you know, all these VR headsets, who realized I can take a tablet display, put it into a cheap headset with some duct tape and take some ski goggles and kind of glue it all together and make this thing. And that's ultimately what became Oculus. And it's really thanks to him going back to what was this simple idea from the mid-90s and bringing it back again that everyone had written off. And now it's because of that we have the Oculus Rift, the Vive, and the PlayStation VR and everything else, because everybody had written that technology off.
Yeah.
So, Leo, we need to do a VR version of This Week in Tech in which you can actually see and play and hold the goodies that we're talking about.
We've already shot portions of two shows with the Nokia Ozo camera, which is a $60,000 immersive camera. It has eight cameras, but also eight microphones. I think audio is very important. Yeah. We shot last week's Mac Break. Alex Lindsay brought it by. He's been reviewing it. We shot last week's Mac Break Weekly and part of the new screensavers yesterday on that. Here's one of the problems. It's not only not real time, it takes 4 hours to stitch 1 minute of video together.
Oh.
So they're still working on the video they shot on Tuesday. And we only shot like 10 minutes. So the workflow is a problem. But we're in the earliest days of this, and I think there's enough appeal already. I mean, the idea of you being able to be in our show. And by the way, when we built our studio and the new studio we're building, we're keeping this in mind that people will be looking behind as well as in front. Normally a television studio or a movie set, there's nothing but garbage everywhere but the 60 or 80 degrees you're seeing. Well, no, we can't do it that way anymore. So everything in the sets now has to be...
No, that's funny, Leo, because when Victoria Smith was on ABC News, she told me once that the hairdressers would only care about the front of her hair.
Right.
They wouldn't even bother trimming the back of her neck. Well,
guess what? Guess what? And they can't just stand on the edge of the shot to come in and give you a powder puff.
Gina Smith, by the way.
Gina Smith. Everybody is going to be able to see everything. And so you have to rethink everything when you're doing this stuff. But I feel like we are. So, yes, I don't think you're going to see these shows in immersive 360 this year or probably even next year. But I admit when we build a new set, that's one of the things we're keeping in mind.
You have to
by 2020, it'll be common.
I use a Theta right now, the Theta S, the Ricoh Theta S, which shoots in 360-degree video, and I can get it out to you 10 minutes later because the quality is a little bit lower. And I shot a lot of video on our last vacation, immersive video. If you go to my YouTube account, youtube.com/Leo Laporte, you can see it. It's not perfect by any means, but you immediately see kind of some of the issues that you're going to have to solve, like this idea that everybody is visible in everything. So, I'm doing a vlog here. I'm standing here, but I don't have to point the camera anymore because everything around me is visible from the sky above to the water below. It's all there. And that's I think for an auteur or a creator or even just a vlogger, that's fascinating. And
if you have to get clearances from everybody who's in the shot.
Nah, I didn't bother with that. $350 camera, $350. And the tools are available on Mac and PC and smartphones and tablets. You can already just do this. I could do it on an iPad and have it out on my blog. And because YouTube and Facebook both support this video, and that means you can watch it with a cardboard or a Gear VR, in some ways, the tools to do this are here at a highly affordable. I mean, this is going to happen pretty quick, I feel. You know, quicker than maybe we even realize. This is a new platform. I was talking on the radio show today about the new platforms. When you look at Apple and you look at these companies that have been around 40 years or 15 years in the case of Google, or Facebook, 10 years in the case of Facebook, these are mature companies. But the future is being invented right now by a number of companies. And there are new platforms. I don't think we're talking about operating systems so much as we're going to talk. Messaging is a new platform. Bots. Microsoft talked a lot about bots at Build this week. Bots are the apps for the new platform. Instead of iOS or Android, it's a messaging platform.
And with every paradigm shift, there's always new winners and losers. And we've seen that every time. And so there will be new billionaires to be minted as a result of these new technologies that we don't even know about yet.
Huge stuff's coming along. Yeah. So VR, AR, messaging. I think if you look at the Echo, the Amazon Echo, that in a way is a messaging platform too, isn't it? Except instead of typing, it's a voice, but it's interactive. Autonomous vehicles, that's going to be a new platform. We are not done yet, and that's good news for all of us.
Right.
Larry Magid is here. He's from CBS Radio News and, of course, his own site, Larry's World, and always a pleasure to talk to Larry. One of the grand old men now, you can say.
Oh!
Technology reporting.
Alexa, tell Leo to stop saying
that. Larry, embrace it.
Embrace it. What are we going to do? Right?
Own it.
Yeah,
own
it. That's true. That's Dwight Silverman. Same thing. Great tech blogger from the Houston Chronicle. Hey, if you've made it this far, after a few decades in the business, that's a good thing, right?
That's right. That's right. Right.
It's better than the alternative.
Just think of all the wisdom you've forgotten.
What? I forgot. Also, one of the young Turks, up and coming, Tim Stevens. Well, I can't even say that about you now.
I'm approaching middle age at this point, or something like that.
Roadshow.com. He's now at CNN.
Look right here.
One of the editor-in-chief, longtime editor-in-chief at Engadget, and also a great friend. It's great to have all three of you. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. As you do contemplate nature's long corridor towards the end, you might start thinking about saving for your retirement, for that house you want to buy, get that down payment together, the kids' college. Yeah, you know, I have some friends who are just having babies, and I tell them, they're going to be in college before you know it. Start saving now. But how do you save? You put it all in a savings account? You might as well put it in a mattress. Do you put it, you must invest, right? Oh, but are you going to manage the investment? Are you prepared to constantly pay attention to what's going on and rebalance and reinvest and think about it and learn and study? That's fun for about a month. Oh, you're going to hire an investment advisor. You know what they charge you? Like 1% to 3% of what you have under investment every year. That means your returns would have to be 3% better every year just to break even. That's not a good way. That's why we love and recommend Wealthfront. Wealthfront is computer-based, automated, long-term investment. We're not talking day trading here. They have built into the software state-of-the-art investment knowledge from some of the best investment people in the world, people like Burton Malkiel and Charles D. Ellis, 200 years of investment prowess. Wealthfront portfolios are based on something called modern portfolio theory. Go to wealthfront.com/twit. You can read about this. They're designed to adjust according to your own personal risk tolerance, so they're absolutely customized for you, but they stay diversified and, most importantly for you, tax efficient. Wealthfront is transparent. It's accessible. You can see all your accounts in one place, whether they're personal, joint, or retirement. You can see every trade Wealthfront makes on your behalf right there on your desktop or your mobile app. And unlike other financial advisors, Wealthfront's not going to bog you down with a bunch of questions. They have really simplified the process. Just a few questions and you'll be investing sooner for as little as $500. That's the minimum investment. You know, it's estimated that more than 90% of portfolios are not invested properly for the long term. Wealthfront has a new feature. This is free. You could try it right now, wealthfront.com/twit. It's called their portfolio review. It'll see if your portfolio is at risk, how diversified your investments are, what you're losing to fees, even minimize taxes, and that is free. You'll also get their recommended portfolio based on your risk profile. It's an amazing thing. And all of this, not 1%, 2%, 3%, 0.25% a year with never any commissions or hidden fees. It's very affordable. In fact, we're going to make it even more so because your first $15,000 when you invest at wealthfront.com/twit is free of charge forever. Not a quarter of 1%, but nothing forever. So that's the way to start the nest egg. Wealthfront.com/twit. I want you to read about it. I never would want you to invest sight unseen, but they've just added artificial intelligence features to this so that they are improving their algorithm all along. And if you look at their performance, even in these tough times, you'll see this is the way to do it. Wealthfront.com/twit. We've heard from so many of you now who have taken advantage of that offer and who are having such great results. Let's see. Did you see Facebook has a special studio in New York where they teach celebrities how to use Facebook? There's Martha Stewart. I thought at first this was her prison photo. She doesn't. she looks so unhappy.
Hard to believe that Martha doesn't know how to use Facebook. She's actually much more tech savvy than you might imagine. But
it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Well, they're going so much into video. I think that has a lot to do.
They really want. Remember, they gave verified profiles early access to this app, Facebook Mentions, that allowed you to stream video. Now they've opened it to everybody.
Right.
All they got was Ricky Gervais petting his cat,
and Robert Scoble doing everything.
Yeah, and it. Yes, I don't think it was a hit. Scoble.
But we're using it here. We're using it here. We've got, we have a lot of, several of our sports people, our baseball writers, were using it during spring training to broadcast from the spring training games. And we're looking for ways to do it here because it's a great, one of the things you can do is you can set it up. A reporter can use it on his Facebook page. And then while they're doing that live feed, we can share that over to our main Houston Chronicle Facebook page and have it right there for people to see. Okay.
Live video's got no future. That's crazy talk. Who would be interested in watching live streams for hours at a time? Oh, never mind.
What that means is that every reporter now has to be a photographer and a television
That's right.
They call it a predator, right? A producer, editor, host.
That's exhausting.
Yeah. It is exhausting, but this is the future. On the other hand, if you're a master of it, look at Donald Trump. I'm being serious. I'm not going to get political here on you. But the candidates who will succeed in politics going forward are people who can master social media and mass media. Trump's done both equally well. But I think it really started with Trump's Twitter feed, which for years has been hysterical. Because it's just been crazy, right?
But
Who knew that was the path to the presidency?
Yeah, it's almost horrifying. But, you know, I don't see him shooting his own video. So we got that something on him there, at least. But,
yet.
And I think that was something that we mentioned earlier about the Model 3 event, why that was a bit of a challenge. We weren't allowed to bring photographers. We weren't allowed to bring videographers. We weren't even allowed to bring proper cameras in. So we were shooting everything on phones. I did sneak in a proper camera to get some pictures later. But for the actual drive, we could only use our phones. So here I am sitting in the car trying to, enjoy the experience, to take everything in, while also filming everything on my smartphone, which isn't exactly a great experience, but it's part of the way it is. People want to see things as it happens, and ultimately, the excitement around that event. It was great to be able to bring people along with the experience. I think that's the beautiful thing about all these online tools we have these days.
I feel like there are a lot of people, museums, Broadway shows, who haven't caught up with the future. The best thing anybody could do is Instagram your thing, right? As long as they don't disrupt it with a flash or something, having people post an Instagram of the Mona Lisa is not going to diminish the value of the Mona Lisa.
Remember that big prize fight in Las Vegas, and people were putting it on Periscope, and there was a bunch of
the UFC
concern because they were paying $100 to watch it on pay-per-view. And I mean, I don't know if you were a serious viewer of that prize fight.
You're not going to Periscope instead.
Exactly. If you really care about the fight, you're not going to watch it on Periscope.
I think people I don't think people understand the value of social media exposure. I'm always shocked when I go in a museum and they say no pictures. Like, what? I'm going to take a picture, print it, and hang it on my wall? What exactly are you trying to sell? Right?
Flash is sometimes important.
I understand. Okay, yeah. And if you're in a movie or a Broadway show, you don't want a lot of camera pick screens up there, as people take pictures. We saw Hamilton last week, and I would be offended if people had pictures of it, but it was so hard for me. I took a picture, as I do usually before the show started, but I would have loved just one little picture. Would have been so great. Hamilton, though, which is the biggest hit on Broadway right now, has absolutely used social media to a T, to perfection. And I think they're quite smart not to allow pick cameras, not because they don't want pictures, but because they don't want the disruption. If you follow Lin-Manuel Miranda's Twitter feed, every day a picture of another celebrity backstage with him at the show. I mean, they're very smart.
Well, remember the Grateful Dead. They were the first band to allow people to record their concerts. And it turned out to be part of the reason for their success was that they allowed bootleg tapes as opposed to fighting it. And their fans loved them.
And lasting success, right?
Absolutely.
They're still beloved today because you can listen to tapes. So, that's a perfect example.
And plus, fans caught some of the audio that the professionals didn't catch, so they were able to recover some of the concerts that otherwise would have never been memorialized.
Yep. That's a lesson that's funny. People are slow to learn, I guess. Let's see. There's a lot of little stuff here shaking down to the bottom of the news tree. How about this one? Let's wrap up with this one. This is a technology I can really get behind. This is from the Mirror, so I don't know if I trust it. A man has built a Scarlett Johansson robot to fulfill his childhood dream, and according to the Mirror, it's terrifyingly realistic. Ooh. Now, after hearing her, the movie with Scarlett Johansson as the voice, I do wish I had a Scarlett Johansson operating system. This guy is just a creep. Just a weird.
I never thought anyone could ruin Scarlett Johansson for me.
That is just,
but this guy has ruined Scarlett Johansson.
How do you think Scarlett Johansson feels?
Oh, man.
Creeped. Yeah.
And who thinks that's scarily realistic? You have a pretty low standard.
Look at her hands.
The hands are really what.
Does she have any rights when it comes to her image being used
that way? It doesn't look like her. I think she would lose in court.
Yeah, for that reason.
That's for true.
He has spent $50,000 on this.
Wow.
Starting, as you can see, from the skeleton.
Wow.
Working his way up. I mean,
3D, and it's 3D printed parts, so he's done a lot of this on a 3D printer.
I admire his initiative.
If it's not an April Fool's joke, you're sure about that?
Oh, maybe it is.
Yeah.
You know, I might have gotten bit. He said, when I was a child, I liked robots. Why? Because I liked watching animation. All children loved it. They were Transformers. After I grew up, I wanted to make one. During this process, a lot of people would say things like, are you stupid? This takes a lot of money. Do you even know how to do it? It's really hard. But now, Actually, that does kind of look like Scarlett Johansson right there. That one kind of looks like her.
Until she moves.
Yeah, until she moves.
Didn't they have that problem in Jaws?
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a fitting place to end this conversation. Thank you so much for being here. Tim Stevens, loved your reporting from the Model 3 event. Congratulations to your wife on her car that she'll be getting in a few years.
Three to five years.
Oh, we didn't mention Bash and Windows. I knew I forgot something. I teased that and everything. Anything to say about that?
As a Cygwin user, I don't see the big deal.
Oh, you know what? This is going to be so much better than Cygwin. In fact, one of the reasons I use a Macintosh and use Linux is I want a real command line with real power. PowerShell, not quite it. I use Cygwin and PuTTY, right? But they're ported versions of these apps. What Microsoft's done is kind of remarkable with Ubuntu. You're actually going to get the actual Ubuntu ELF binaries. I presume you could compile your own because I presume you're going to get GCC and all the tools that come on the Unix platform. This is great. This makes me actually consider Windows 10. It's not Linux. Don't get confused. It's more like Wine reverse Wine. So Wine, which lets you run Windows programs on Linux by emulating Linux calls, translating Windows calls into Linux calls, this is doing the opposite. It's translating the calls from the Linux apps into commands that Windows can respond.
So we're going to have Ubuntu.dll?
Oh, my God. I bet there is. Come to think of it.
Yep.
I bet there is. But I have to say, this is going to be something that will make me be much more likely to use Windows. Somebody said, that's the April Fool's joke. No, it's serious. Anyway, thank you, Tim. Really appreciate it. TheRoadShow.com.
Right. Thank you.
To follow Tim's coverage, automotive coverage. What's the next big automotive event?
We've got a little bit of a break. I think Paris is the next big automotive show, but we've got a lot of great stuff coming up on the site. We just did a shootout between the Audi S7 and the Tesla Model S, as a matter of fact, which the winner may surprise you. So that's on the site right now.
No kidding. I'd be very interested. I have an Audi A8, which I really love. Lisa has an S5, but that's the A8's the car I'll be trading in for a Model X someday.
Yeah, those are great cars.
Someday.
Yeah, someday. Yeah. Someday my ex will come. Larry Magid, CBS Radio News. And don't forget larrysworld.com, connectsafely.org.
Org. Yep.
Which is a great place for parents to learn about the internet and how to make sure their kids are connecting safely. And you've done a great thing.
A lot of fun today.
Always a pleasure.
Great. Great to meet you, Tim, and see you as usual, Dwight.
Yep.
Nice to see you, Larry.
Someday somebody will write a great Windows Vista book.
Someday. And in fact, they're going to bundle them with the Model X. You could get a free one.
Larry, you need to come back to Houston so we can have some more barbecue. That was great.
Oh, barbecue in Houston.
Ooh,
that's right.
I'll drive my Tesla all the way to Houston.
There you go.
Yeah, that's enticing.
That would be a challenge. See if you can find superchargers along the way.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
Sure you can.
Yeah. Yes, Interstate 10. They've got them all along Interstate 10.
There you go. Yeah. But Texas is a big state, though. That's a long way to go.
True.
But it's worth it.
Absolutely. If you're ever in Houston, look up Dwight Silverman, the Houston Chronicle. Great to have you all here.
Great to be here. Thanks, Leo.
Don't forget, we got a great triangulation tomorrow, a really special episode with Bill Atkinson, one of the greats in computing, joining us.
I'm going to make a point of watching.
Yeah.
That's terrific.
Put your questions in the chat room. We'll make sure everybody's questions get answered. That's 11 a.m. tomorrow, Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. And we do Twit every Sunday afternoon, right after the radio show, about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. If you like to watch live, we'd love it if you do. The chat room is always a big contributor to the show. You can be in there at irc.twit.tv anytime. There's always somebody in the chat room. I'll go in the middle of the night, and there's people having a nice conversation, mostly Australians. If you can't watch live, on-demand audio and video is always available for all of our shows at the website, twit.tv. But you can also subscribe in all those podcatchers and Stitcher and Slacker and Spotify. We're on Spotify. Soon we'll be on Google All Access. What do they call it? Google Play Music. They're going to add podcasts, and we'll be one of the first ones in there. And, of course, the great Twit apps on every platform, thanks to our independent developers who've done some really nice stuff on Apple TV and Roku and iOS and Android and Windows Phone and Windows 10 and all of that stuff. Thanks to you for being here. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
Is in the can. Bye-bye. Bye.
Hey. Doing the Twit.
So can I listen to the show on Alexa, on the Echo?
You can. It's hard to get the exact...
Play Leo Laporte.
No, that won't work.
Getting your book from Audible. Resuming the love song of Miss Queenie Hennessy.
Wow. Very close. Very close.
For you, for your
thwart. That's my new title, Queenie Hennessy. That's me.
No, I told you my wife was an Audible.